It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. Amy Webb is here, our futurist. Lindsay Turrentine, editor-in-chief at CNET. Jason Heiner, editor-chief at Tech Republic. We are going to talk about a lot of very deep philosophical things. China versus the U.S. in artificial intelligence. Mark Zuckerberg versus Congress. And Waymo versus the citizens of Mountain View. It's all coming up next on TWiT.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT This Week in Tech, episode 662, recorded Sunday, April 15th, 2018. Scraped on the back end. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Aptiv. Aptiv produces audio-based workouts created by certified personal trainers, available through a mobile app. Get 30% off new annual memberships when you visit Aptiv, aaptiv.com/twit. And by Molecule. Molecule is the world's first molecular air purifier that reduces symptoms for allergy and asthma sufferers. $75 off your first order when you visit molecule.com, M-O-L-E-K-U-L-E.com. And enter the promo code TWIT. And by Rocket Mortgage, by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/TWIT2. And by Audible. For a free audiobook with a 30-day free trial, go to audible.com/TWIT or text TWIT to 500-500. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, the show where we get together with the best tech journalists in the business and talk about the week's tech news. And this is a special TWiT because April 17th, 2005, the very first TWiT was recorded with Patrick Norton, Kevin Rose, Robert Herron, David Prager. And we are, so this is as close as you get to our 13th anniversary episode. And you know what? We put together a panel of people I love and cupcakes. So we won't eat the cupcakes yet. They are here. But as soon as I introduce you, you may dive in. We'll start all the way over to my right with the author of Follow the Geeks, Tech Republic's editor-in-chief, my good buddy, the guy who got me elected president of the internet, Jason Heiner. Thank you, Jason, for being here.
A pleasure. Very glad to be
here. What brings you out
to
this coast?
Got some meetings at work with many of the awesome people at CBS Interactive.
People like maybe Lindsay Turrentine, editor-in-chief at CNET.com,
yes.
Perhaps.
Yeah. I hope I get to be in a meeting with you.
Is this an annual?
Yeah, let's make sure we do.
Oh,
let's
aren't
do
they cute?
Let's
all
right. Do it.
Okay, break it up,
let's
you two. Is this an annual thing for CBS Interactive?
Like, actually, so I'm here for RSA.
And then
a couple days at RSA and a couple days in the office.
RSA is a big security conference.
It is.
A lot of fun.
Sorry,
Yeah. Lindsay's also here, and Lindsay brought her daughter. It's so nice to see how grown up your daughter is. Oh, she disappeared.
She's back there.
She's got her iPad.
She's here to see I called it Nerd Hollywood.
Man. Nerd Hollywood. Not nearly as fun as real Hollywood, I can assure you. Also, another book author and a good friend, Amy Webb, is here. She is the founder of the Future Today Institute, the author of a book. This is how I met Amy, talking about her book, The Signals Are Talking, Why Today's Fringe is Tomorrow's Mainstream. Hello, Amy Webb.
Hello. Congrats on the anniversary. That's
13.
So cool.
Can you believe it? I mean, this
man.
Podcasting began in earnest in 2004, late 2004. We started in the spring.
You were really
2005.
At the beginning of all of this. Yeah, it's amazing.
If you told me then that in 13 years you'll still be doing this show, I would have killed myself. No, I would have said, oh, I hope we have cupcakes, please. We got red velvet. I'm sorry, Amy, we don't have any way of sending them back east, but we have got red velvet. I'm going to try one.
Attach one to an email.
I'm going to get the H.
I remember being here for the 10th anniversary. While I was writing my book, I came here for
the
10th anniversary.
And what do we have? Cupcakes.
You did have cupcakes.
Yeah.
That's right. Should
cupcakes be crunchy?
Like, 10 seemed like so... amazing that this thing was still going strong after 10 years. Now, to be fair, most of the podcasts that were going strong back then are long since history, but this one is seems like it just keeps getting stronger.
We've survived long enough to live through podcast renaissance, which is going
multiple.
On right now.
Yeah.
You have. I think you have proven the podcast case.
It's kind of funny.
Yeah.
Well, in a way, I feel like we're now such old hat that, all the new podcasts get all the attention, Serial and, you know, all the WNYC stuff and Gimlet Media and all that stuff. So
but they don't have cupcakes.
Yeah. They will in 13 years. Please be my guest. Red Velvet, vanilla, chocolate.
All right, I'm taking a vanilla one. I'm taking the exclamation point. Cause
and your daughter, nice. By the way, can have one.
Dang.
You want to come have a cupcake? No? Burke's going to have one, that's for sure.
Excellent.
Can I reach you a cupcake, Jason?
I'm vegan, so I doubt that.
Oh, these aren't vegan. Are they vegan cupcakes? The Red Velvet has coffee in them. That's almost vegan. All right. I didn't realize you were vegan.
Yeah.
You know, a funny thing on YouTube, I think it was Zeynep Tufekci who noticed this in an editorial in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago, that there's just a natural thing in the algorithm. And really, one of the things we talk a lot about these days is algorithms and how algorithms are driving technology in kind of a weird way. But one of the things about YouTube's algorithms is no matter what you look at, it pushes you something more extreme. So if you go to look, she mentioned this, a vegetarian video, it'll suggest a vegan video.
If it's vegan, it'll suggest a raw vegan.
Raw vegan, right. And then, you know,
and then
nuts.
That,
you want a little nuts?
And,
yeah, water.
You know, water and carrots.
Water
you
and
know,
air?
Like
okay,
Steve
we can do
Jobs.
That. But there is something that it's not that the engineers are doing that. It's not that any humans are thinking about that. It's just that this is what algorithms do. Their algorithms are tuned to improve engagement. And over time, they get better thanks to machine learning and big data. And what they learn is, this is how you engage people. You get more and more extreme. But unfortunately, it's not just in dietary things. It's also in, you know,
political
and, and on and on. I mean, is that something that you and your research kind of noticed in the past? Or is this something new and unexpected?
Well, I mean, it's new in the digital realm, but it's certainly not unexpected. So if in the digital realm, attention is currency, right? The way that you would liken this is to what's going to compel somebody to keep, I guess, spending, and in this case, it'd be their time. At some point, you reach a certain threshold and you need more, right? Which is why we see gradients of everything from porn to...
Yeah, porn gets more extreme,
right?
Doesn't it? Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, it's just like we need...
Stimulus.
Bigger, better, yeah, all the time.
Yeah, actually, the prime example of this is television, which started fairly innocently and turned into Morton Downey Jr. and more and more extreme realism and reality shows.
Or staged extreme realism.
Staged.
I mean, I think we know that it has to get more and more extreme.
Newspapers tend to get more sensationalistic. They don't have to. When it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen in TV when you get somebody like CBS's Edward R. Murrow who said, no, we're going to be the Tiffany Network. We're not going to go down that road. Or somebody like the New York Times. We're not going to go down that road. Let the National Enquirer go down that road. But it doesn't seem in tech that there's there's anybody saying, no, let's be responsible. Let's not maximize 100% for attention. Let's be more responsible. I think the pressure is going to be on for YouTube, now that people know that they're doing this, and Facebook and all these others, to draw the line at some point. That's the problem. They're not drawing the line.
But is there also the user responsibility part of that? I mean, there is this sort of, if you're offered a platter of
it's our responsibility.
Less extreme and
no,
more extreme options,
yeah.
We have to stop picking the extreme ones.
But I don't think, do you think humans can do that?
You know, my son, who's not in the audience, he said the other day, he's like, oh, I know what clickbait is. And yeah. I know, he said, I just consider it a clickbait tax. And so about once a week, I decide I'm just going to go in on clickbait. Like, I know what this is. I know it's ridiculous.
But it's a tax.
And I'm just going to click on it and pay the tax and enjoy it and then limit myself in the future. Which I thought was an interesting way to look at it.
Interesting. It's not that simple of a transaction, though, because on the one hand, you're clicking and absorbing whatever the content is, but you're still being scraped on the back end. All of these systems, the business model for all of them is surveillance.
That sounds painful. I don't want to be scraped on the back end.
Very few people do, but that's kind of extreme. Some people do. I'm sure.
You know, if you watch Pat on the back end videos, you'll get scraped on the back end videos later.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Amy. I should not have derailed that.
I do this every time.
No, but here's the example. Mark Zuckerberg testifying in Congress Some members of Congress had different agendas, but a number of them wanted to know about the what do they call them? The dark dossiers that Facebook gathers on people who aren't even members. They're getting scraped on the back end.
Well, the interesting thing is, you know, the chasing the clicks, right, is kind of what we're getting at. And as
boy, it's ruined blogging.
You could say, certainly. And there's a really good post on this on, I think it was on Facebook, by somebody who's been in the industry a long time, been on the show many times, Lance Ulanoff.
Love Lance, yeah.
Right? Great guy, was terrific.
Lance is kind of a victim of this, isn't he? Because
yes.
He went to Mashable
yes.
to be editor-in-chief, and Mashable is the poster child for chasing
clicks.
Or it was.
It was.
And then
what happened, right?
Yeah.
And so Lance wrote this great post, very kind of introspective about the fact that I got really good at doing this. And he was one of the best. We used to, you know, joke, and he would send, sometimes we would do some really good, at the height of when this was going on, we would do something really good. Like, I think one time we did 20 things to do that'll lose your geek card or something. Got a zillion pages in traffic. And I remember Lance sending me a message saying, I just, you know, went in and excoriated my team for not thinking of this idea first.
Oh.
You know, great
he
quick
got
stuff.
So,
but
I understand why. You feel like you have a responsibility to your staff.
Right.
That, you know, and your owners, that you need to generate revenue, that this is what they brought you here for. And even somebody like Lance, who is editor-in-chief at PC Magazine, who really has real, strong journalistic credentials, got sucked in by this.
Yes.
And in fact, this is kind of what this mea culpa in Medium that he wrote is.
Yes.
Exiting media, pondering new rules for an old profession.
And the thing is Mashable's kind of the prime example, but it's not just Mashable, right? Is that you follow the clicks, and eventually what you find, and a lot of places are having their comeuppance on this, is that you can't monetize that. There's a great quote.
Oh God,
there,
I hope that's true.
Where Lance goes to his editor, and his editor's like, they're about to put up a paywall, and he goes to him and said, you got to stop. And he's like, why? And he said, because everything that we have, you can find anywhere else.
Content is free.
Well, and here's the thing: it used to be, before algorithms started to rule publishing, that the simple way to get more traffic was to write more content.
Right.
It's almost like dumbly simple, but
right.
that's sort of no longer.
That's kind of demand media, right? That was
yeah.
a whole,
right.
There was a whole generation a couple of years back of sites that were created around Google searches. Like you monetize the search for tortoiseshell belt buckles and you write a dumb, meaningless article, but you know you'll get traffic because
yeah.
people search for that.
It's like WikiHow or
yeah.
any of the big how-to engines, which kind of got shut down algorithmically. But here's the interesting thing to me. I think that algorithms are very good at understanding what people want for a little while, but people are the smartest algorithm, and we start to burn out.
Yeah.
We all know exactly what a clickbait headline sounds like.
That's a good point.
And we now are starting to get bored and move
on. That's what
on.
Hit Facebook. That's why Facebook deprecated the publishers, right?
So, I think it depends on how you define the we.
Yeah.
I mean, we
who?
Right? Like, we may understand what a clickbait headline is, but I mean,
well, ultimately, it only matters if traffic goes down.
But I think the larger we is starting to understand what that looks like.
The larger we totally got duped by fake news on Facebook. So I'm not a big, you know, like, I don't know if I gave a lot of credence to the we here. I think that the algorithms are much more powerful than we give them credit for.
So
I don't know. I think maybe you're right. It worked. But maybe we won't get fooled again. You know, maybe now we go, oh, that didn't work. I mean, Mashable is gone effectively, right? Facebook stopped, deprecated link baiting. And I think I don't think Facebook did it altruistically because they want to protect the
Facebook does nothing altruistically.
No, they did it because it wasn't working anymore.
Right. Yep. Well, and I think
it was trashing up it was polluting the stream.
I actually don't give we credit and sort of, I don't think that the larger we has grown wiser. Necessarily. I just think that humans are susceptible to trends. We get bored very quickly. We recognize trends very, and then we move on to new ones. And there's something else out there that is going to replace it. And I think that there's a good reason. People, if you spend much time on Facebook and have continued to spend much time, even before last week, Facebook's getting kind of dead.
Yeah.
It's just not that interesting anymore. And I think people are starting to move on. I mean, there's a reason that nobody under the age of 25 spends any time on Facebook.
Yeah.
Yeah. About 5 years ago, so we sort of looked at this pretty hard because we were going, you know, we're like a smaller niche player, right? And so
when you say we're Tech Republic?
Tech Republic, sorry. Tech Republic is a smaller niche player. And ZDNet, the other site that I spend, you know, a lot of time on. And we sort of got to this point where it's like, okay, we could go all in on, like Lindsay's saying, like put more content out there and try to keep up with the rat race. And what we decided at the time was to go in a different direction, was that our users were just, we don't want to produce more stuff. Our conclusion was, and when we asked our users, we don't want to produce more stuff that really doesn't have a lot of value. So what we did instead was really listen to what our users tell us, the stuff that we create that brings them value.
That's, to me, responsible journalism. But I gather, Amy, you don't feel like that's widespread.
Well, no. I mean, I can tell you that Tronc.
Tronc.
Lowercase Tronc. So before Michael Farrow, who was the chairman, left.
The old Chicago Tribune, right?
Right. And as a Chicago, like, I'm originally from Chicago, and I grew up with the Chicago, you know, like, it was heartbreaking watching this whole place get dismantled by somebody who had never worked inside of a newsroom and, quite frankly, knows very little about AI. And the grand plan was that he had acquired over 100 AI patents that were going to be used to automatically generate content because the business model was predicated on just like barfing up a lot of news.
I remember the speech he gave to the troops.
Well, I'll tell you something. I read every one of those patents. And not only did basically none of them have any direct applicability to anything that was happening at the Chicago Tribune, but any of the automation that was being discussed, like, it was better spelled out in Magic Leap. You know, Amazon is already pretty far ahead. Like, everybody else was pretty far ahead. But in traditional media, I think there is still this idea that more like creating huge amounts of content automagically through the miracles and wonders of machine learning, right, is somehow going to create enough traffic that helps boost the numbers. So you saw that at Tronc.
I got to show this because it's so crazy.
That press release was insane.
Well, let me show you the Tronc video.
Oh, this is awful.
With Malcolm Cassell, who I've known for years. This is the future of journalism.
This is the future of content. It doesn't get much better than that. If you care about media and technology, this is the place to be.
See if you can identify any actual concrete ideas in this at all.
Tronc stands for Tribune Online Content, and it also means the pooling of resources.
It's about meeting in the middle, having a tech startup culture meet a legacy corporate culture, and then evolving and changing.
Eat it alive.
And that's really the fun part. That's exciting.
We have great titles. We produce tons of great content every single day. We're really focused on how we deliver it to people in a way that they want to consume it more and more.
More and more.
One of the ways we want to harness the power of our journalism is to have a optimization group. This Tronc team will work with all of the local markets to harness the power of our local
almost journalism. Feels like a parody video from Ready Player One. I'm just saying.
It totally does.
So that we reach the biggest global audience possible.
This is IOI.
Our content really valuable to the broadest possible audience.
All right, that's enough of that.
Yeah, I can't take anymore.
I'll play the opposite of that. You know who's doing really well? The Information. So
I love The Information. Jessica Lessen is a genius.
That's right. And they're not trying to, you know, this is the opposite method, right?
But this is that paywall. They charge $400 right. a year. I pay it. They have some of the best journalists, right? And they really focus not on link bait, but on really what you said.
They understand their
valuable content to your users. Because you have to earn that $400.
These big conglomerations, there was all this consolidation. And so you have these huge, like Tronc, you know, there are too many news organizations within this big bubble, and you just can't support all of them, and they can't all be the same thing to all people. So The Information, I think, is succeeding because it's not trying to be everything. It's trying to do one thing exceptionally well, and it does. And so people are willing to pay for it, and they're able to sustain that way.
It doesn't feel like that's a model that can be used.
It's a model that works for doing something
for
specific.
For
and
something,
I think that Jessica's a genius also, and she's really straightforward about what she's doing. And
she has some real vision. I'm really
good at it. And I think it's going to allow her to continue to do what she wants to do, which is pursue serious journalism about the Valley, with the caveat that that's probably never going to extend beyond the Valley unless the same model gets applied to a different topic.
Well, it's kind of like what we do here. We're not trying to get a mass audience, right? She's not trying to get a mass audience. But is there room for, I mean, CNET is, Tech Republic is to some degree. I mean, you have a focus. But certainly CBS Interactive is. There has to be room for mass media as well. How does mass media, can it find its way without descending the link bait?
I think it has. I mean, if you look at what, I'm obviously going to say this, but if you look at what CBS Interactive has done, we have continued to serve an audience the content that they want in a serious manner over time. And that doesn't mean we don't expand. We expand aggressively into lots of different parts of what that means. We cover culture, we cover science.
And you don't get pressure from CBS to drive numbers and stuff like that. You must.
Well, we're always looking to grow, but we look to grow by pleasing a broad audience and talking to them about what matters
right
every single day and what matters to them. The thing that is difficult is that what matters to them changes a lot. People change.
Yep.
Generations change.
That's hard to do.
We are constantly looking very closely.
I'm dealing with that now, yeah.
What's changing?
TWIT is very different 13 years later. And as a broadcaster, I always told broadcasters, don't chase the audience because it's chasing your tail. You can't. So it's for me, and I guess for niche broadcasters or niche journalists like Jessica, having a vision and pursuing that vision and hoping that what you're doing, being true to yourself, true to that vision, will generate enough revenue, enough of an audience that you can survive. But it's very different from a mass marketer or a mass media enterprise, which really does need to chase the audience, I guess.
Needs to be nimble and understand what the audience
wants. The audience.
Right. And I think that I think we fell down a rabbit hole where we started to think as an industry, and this is the Mashable topic that we're talking about, that we could tell the audience what they wanted by almost beating them at their own game, right? By using machines to tell us what they were going to want before they knew what they wanted. And the reality is that everybody gets wise to that eventually and says, no, I'm interested in something else now. And circling all the way back to that Facebook issue that we were talking about a minute ago, I noticed that somebody in the chat room said, I don't think Facebook is going away. I have the same number of friends this week that I did last week. But what I found is interesting is that, that's because people are just walking away. They're wandering off somewhere else. I actually removed the app from my phone.
Me too, yeah.
And my behavior radically changed within a week.
I'm so much happier. Yeah.
Right, I can go back and find it on the desktop if I want.
Did everybody delete Instagram too?
No, that's the thing. I actually just switched right over to Instagram. And I know.
But Facebook's getting the same. But they're not, Amy, they're not getting the same signals from Instagram that they got from Facebook. Not nearly the richness of information, are they?
I mean, do any of us actually know for sure?
No. I am certain that my day-to-day behavior, the things that I search for, the things that I do online, affects what shows up in my Instagram feed. Sure. The targeted ads that show up know exactly who I am and what I'm doing.
Yeah. I buy more stuff from Instagram than any other source.
Is 3 to 4x, I think,
really?
Any of the other social networks on ads.
Sure.
They're click-through rate.
I don't presume that Instagram's not keeping a really close eye on what I'm doing. That's where my friends are.
Yeah.
They are not on Facebook.
Same.
It's very straightforward.
This is like such a push-pull thing.
Do you guys use Snap?
No, not much.
But I bet your daughter does.
She's not allowed to
yet.
You have
the smartest daughter ever.
I think so.
My kids do, but they're in their 20s.
You know, this user thing is such a push-pull thing because you obviously have
what's
to
wrong?
Stay
Wait a minute, before you go into this, what's wrong with Snap?
Where should I start?
Oh, boy.
I think it was in 2014 or 15. 16. Snap filed some very, very interesting patents. I will see if I can pull them up. But they had to do with a online advertising marketplace that used machine learning and object recognition to automatically surface sellable things within a photo that others could buy ads against. And to me, they were also describing in this thing what that system would look like. To me, that very, very much looked like the next generation of auction-based ads for display.
So are you saying that Snap would look at things in your pictures?
Yeah. So you've got a bunch of cupcakes there.
They're going to start selling me cupcakes?
So, yeah. So there may be filters that appear. Or like stories, like part of the feed where I'm being targeted because, or you're being targeted with something related to a cupcake, or you know, I'm drinking Topo Chico.
I've always suspected that the reason Amazon keeps trying to get cameras in my house is that, right?
It's hard to know too what's driving the choices that targeting makes, but this is not just Instagram. It's not just Snapchat. I mean, I went on vacation to Hawaii last week, rented a Jeep. I did it through Turo. It's kind of like Airbnb for car rentals. It was a great experience. I know that I talked about Jeeps with my friends and on text, and I was discussing it all the time and taking pictures of the Jeep. And now I am being advertised Jeeps
Jeep ads for the rest
constantly
of your life.
In Twitter.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think I actually tweeted about Jeeps. I'm just saying that this is pervasive. It's not.
And it's all interconnected.
All social. I mean, it's not just Instagram. It's not just
everywhere.
Facebook. It's all social media.
Well,
it's
in fact, I think there are a lot of companies saying, thank God Mark is taking all the heat right now because we don't have to be, we could just kind of, oh, yeah, that's too bad about that Facebook thing. and I'm sure Google's number one on that list. There's a Zuckerberg. I'm just going to play this. This is risky, but I trust our chat room. This is a Zuckerberg meme called smile.exe. Let's see.
See that guy over there? That's a smile.
Like the Terminator, he's trying out smiles.
That's good. Maybe you could practice in front of a mirror or something.
Okay, I just had to watch that. Zuck does have a somewhat robotic persona. He's not exactly the poster boy for warm and fuzzy. Although the stock went up after Zuck's testimony,
he kept it so even keel. It was impressive to me how able he was to just use the same answer over and over again, apparently without shame.
My team will get back to you on that, Senator.
I don't know.
I think there was a drinking game at Facebook on, or maybe at Google, on how many times he said senator or congressman, congresswoman.
So here's a list of all of the things that Facebook's team will get back to. I'm glad somebody was making a list. There's quite a few. Where are the Russians hiding? If I delete my account, how long does Facebook keep my data? Does Facebook delete the backups? What apps did Facebook ban? What about audits? How many bots has Facebook taken down? What regulations would Facebook collaborate with Congress on? Does Facebook use cross-device tracking? Where do people affected live? Who has the data that Cambridge Analytica has? Who else has it? What are you doing about Russian interference? All of these.
He knew the answers to
more than 20 of them.
Most of those. I am certain.
Was it
Congress that was at fault then? Were the members of Congress who were at fault for not pursuing this?
I think letting
him off the hook, letting him say that?
I think journalists spent a lot of time last week making fun of Congress people who didn't
know anything.
Understand how Facebook works. And I honestly think that the reason that happened is because Zuck played it so cool.
Yeah.
He was so dispassionate and a little bit disingenuous about his answers that I think they didn't even know. Like, there were people who wanted to make fun of somebody and turn to Congress.
Well, while everybody was busy playing on Twitter and making fun, Facebook legislation that Facebook wrote went into effect or went up for a vote and looks like will go into effect in the state of Maryland.
Oh,
that
and
all,
tell
that
us about
simultaneously.
That. What was that?
Right. So if you'll remember, every big media outlet was touting their exclusive sit down with Sheryl Sandberg. And of course, she was on a media tour where over and over again, she talked about industry leading industry leading ideas, industry leading policies, which is all lobbyist code for regulation. So days before, while she's doing this and days before Zuckerberg shows up on the Hill, Facebook was meeting with lawmakers in different states, one of them being Maryland, where, and I can find the link to this, but Facebook wrote the legislation.
See, on the surface of this, this sounds like good legislation. Plans to regulate political ads on Facebook, right?
Right, but they, so nothing is, like, everything that happened with Zuckerberg giving testimony, that was all that was all for show.
Theater.
That was all for show. But yeah. And so everybody was making fun of it and they were very distracted. But on the back end, we were getting scraped on the back end.
We got scraped on the back end, folks. So Will Castleberry, Facebook's vice president for state policy, says, yeah, we helped draft the Maryland legislation and we look forward to implementing it. Now, that's not necessarily bad. That means they want to get the heat off of them. Maybe they found a way that they think will help.
We believe. But, Leo, look, go back. So this was
we
the
believe
key thing.
This bill will be a national model for the other 49 states to follow. Avoiding,
right.
by the way, federal regulation. Right.
Right. And if there's some regulation that gets started, that takes all of the heat off of
right.
Zuckerberg, because technically nobody broke any laws. So this is all about avoiding. This is all about showing up in public, keeping the share price high, and avoiding federal regulation.
So part of the problem is that the laws that affect broadcasters about political ads, that they have to, for instance, reveal who bought the ad, don't apply to digital.
Right.
And this is the federal laws, the Honest Ads Act. Is Facebook supporting the Honest Ads Act? I think they are. Or not. This Maryland law looks a lot like the Honest Ads Act. It says, here, this is an article from the Baltimore Sun. It resembles legislation in Congress aimed at monitoring political advertising on social media. It would affect Google, by the way, as well as Facebook. New York, California, Connecticut also weighing their own measures. We want to keep the platforms accountable. I'm trying to find the part where it says what.
Yeah, whether they are or not, they will have to. Really what all of this is about at the end is that, and I know I've said this before on the show, but there's three companies that know data better than anybody else, and they're eating the world, they're disrupting industries, and they are undermining the privacy of people every single day, more and more, right? Facebook, Amazon, and Google. And they're doing it largely with a black box of data that they control, and that, you know, data being the new oil, they're using that to become one of the, you know, three of the most powerful companies in the history of humanity. And the transparency issue is a big part of the issue. Facebook, the least transparent. Amazon somewhere in the middle, Google a little bit more transparent of what they do with the data and all that. So all of these companies, you can bet over the next, over the coming years, are going to be under enormous pressure to tell what data they're actually collecting, what they do with it, what it's worth to them, and what they can do to actually empower people to better understand this and take, you know, responsibility for it.
Well, it is so interesting. I think what you said is such a great summary of what we're dealing with here. And the analogy of data as the new oil is a really compelling one. And what's fascinating about that is this is the first time probably in human history when the oil or the diamonds or the gold or whatever it is actually us.
Yes.
And we're being mined.
We're being mined for our money. It's like, it's basically an outgrowth of the advertising industry plus a lot more on top of that. And shouldn't we at least know when we're being mined, right?
Yes.
And when we're offering up bits of ourselves to somebody who's going to then turn around and sell to us. It's almost like we are giving something away and then being asked to buy it back through purchases.
Yeah.
That we make due to targeting.
I have to say, though, that on the face of it, the idea that that Facebook would work with Maryland legislators to try to craft something that is both, you know, helpful and something that Facebook could live with is not necessarily a bad thing. That's how politics works, Amy, right? You're trying
right,
to reach consensus.
Right, and it's not unprecedented.
Not
right,
at all.
I mean, that is what lobbying is.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
So, I mean, I think my job is to collect data and to model it and to figure out what all of it means and what the next order risk and opportunity is many, many years into the future.
Right.
But one of the early signals that we look for are contradictions. So to me, it was very, like, these were some weak signals that I was paying attention
right.
to over the past couple of weeks. The fact that sort of quietly this legislation was being written, it potentially becomes the model. It eludes some regulatory challenges right around the same time that it becomes apparent that our data is being continually mined, refined, and productized, but in ways that we may not have thought through or intended. Like all this sort of constellation of interesting facts and data over the past couple of weeks, you know, I think points us in a direction that we should be concerned about. But it's hard to be concerned and to really think through things when the spectacle is so fascinating and fun. I mean, it was fun to watch all of this happening, right?
Yeah.
Was it fun for everybody, though? I mean, I think it was fun for us.
It looked like it was
but
fun
I,
for Mark.
I think that most people, if you ask them, like, did you see what happened this week? They'd be like, oh, yeah, Mark Zuckerberg, he looks like Data from Star Trek.
Yeah, yeah.
That's it.
That was it.
That's what most people got out of that. Mark Zuckerberg is boring.
You think, Amy, that Mark walked away saying, yes, victory?
I mean, I would have if I was him. Yeah. He escaped any serious questions. Clearly, I mean, did you hear some of the questions? I think it was Senator Orrin Hatch who was trying to suss out whether or not Facebook and Twitter were kind of the same thing.
I know.
And I think one of the questions...
That was depressing.
I might have him confused with Lindsey Graham, but somebody asked the question... is Twitter the same as Facebook? And it's like, it wasn't even rhetorical. It wasn't,
yeah.
I mean, you know, so, I mean, he escaped unscathed. If he had come on, you know, if he had gone in front of people who wouldn't have had to ask, you know, people were asking questions about like whether or not, even if you log out of Facebook, you're still being tracked. It's a clear indication that they don't understand cookies, right?
Yeah.
So like if he had actually faced people that asked serious questions, or if anybody who was up there that didn't understand the tech could have and would have pressed on the other sort of civil liberties piece of this, I think it would have been different.
I think the platform was designed not to even allow that chat if somebody wanted to. And I observed this before it began. I said, this is really just going to be a chance for a member of Congress to stand up, say something that they can use in an ad later, because in the Senate, they got 5 minutes.
Yeah.
In the House, they got 4 minutes. There was no time for follow up. Right. Mark very cleverly used up the clock by, you know, doing longer answers, which many members of Congress were at pains to interrupt trying to get their second question in.
Yeah. Yeah. He even drank his water slowly.
Yeah. Whoever designed it with Facebook in mind, frankly. It wasn't so. Yeah. I don't know that I don't want to be I don't want to be Alex Jones here and a conspiracy theorist. But
I don't think it's a conspiracy just to say that you know
they're in each other's pockets.
Well, they played the
they
game.
They literally relied on Facebook to get elected. I mean, that was a good, you know, like how much money did each one of those? There's a great story somewhere. Somebody
they all got money from Mark,
and not just the tangible, not the obvious money, but. Every one of them relied on Facebook to get elected. Every one of them.
That's a larger issue that probably isn't for us, but there's the larger political issue. We talked about this on Wednesday. There's an economic theory, I think it's called the Peltzman theory, that there are three constituents here. There's monopolies, big business, there's politicians, and there's users. And they each have kind of differing goals. The politicians want to get reelected. The users want to pay less or... You know, in the case of Facebook, where it's free, maybe, I don't know, get spied on less. And the big businesses want as minimal regulation as they can get to continue on with what they're doing. And what happens is you get this kind of nice little feedback loop and everybody gets kind of what they want. Nobody is 100% happy. But at the same time, we don't get any kind of the voters really don't get any kind of privacy protection or regulation of these companies because that's not what politicians are looking for. In fact, Facebook's very helpful to them. They're not trying to shut down Facebook.
No, and there was somebody, I wish I could remember who wrote this piece, but there was a piece sort of documenting which politicians went up to Zuckerberg afterward and basically fawned over him.
Yeah.
We're so proud of what you started in your dorm room.
He's a kingmaker.
This is the symbol of American success. There was, I don't think, a lot of interest in actually angering or unsettling him outside of that grandstanding, for sure. But I think it would be interesting to talk for a second about whether or not people would have the appetite to pay for a service like Facebook. We were just talking about
that. They brought that up.
Journalism, they brought it up. People have been bringing it up for the whole week. Hey, what if we paid for it? Do you need to change your business model, Facebook? And I think this is, again, I keep coming back to this, but it's sort of a personal responsibility thing. I don't think that there's any actual appetite for paying for social media. As soon as any service starts to bring up a fee, people freak out and walk away, which is weird because we'll pay what, like $12, $13, $14 to go to the movies?
Yeah.
It's kind of confounding.
As much time as people spend on it. I mean, I completely agree completely. I never thought people would pay for the information either, that it would survive more than a year, but they did eventually.
Well, there's a key difference, though. There have been plenty of studies. The information was always a paid product.
Right.
Challenge is there's a cognitive bias.
Once it's free,
when something has been when something was free, and now you're being compelled for whatever reason to pay, that it feels like something is being taken away from us. And historically speaking, regardless of what industry or field it is, we won't do it.
It does work sometimes. Like think about with cell phones, we completely destroyed the value of cell phones for about 5 or 6 years there. And then eventually we got to the point where now we're paying, whatever, $40 a month or $30 a month or having to buy one separately.
But it was a different type of phone. That the free, you're talking about the free model?
Right. Well, when it used to be, you get a free upgrade, you get, you pay $200 for your phone, which was really, massively subsidized.
Now you're paying, everybody's paying. You would get the phones for free. You would get a free phone. When I lived there, the early smartphones were free. You just signed up for the service. But once the truly smartphones hit, the first smartphone that I had was an iMode. From NTT Docomo, which was a totally different kind of phone. Everything else was free, but you had to pay for that. We've shifted over to the fancy models like that people pay for, because there's never been an alternative. There's never been a way not to pay for a brand new iPhone.
There's also this sort of half-paid model. I mean, I live in Berkeley. There's a regional news site called Berkeley Side, which I'm a huge fan of. They've done a fantastic job creating a serious local publication that's internet only, and it's first in the nation. They just raised $1 million from its readers in a direct public offering.
Wow,
interesting.
Small local news.
Isn't that interesting?
High quality.
That's
product.
That's Berkeley, though.
Totally free.
That's Berkeley.
Still,
but no,
still,
that's Berkeley.
There's something to be said, model. Though. Yeah. Like you do a very good job, and then you say, "Look," and it's kind of the NPR model too, right? Like, please pay for this thing. We're gonna give it to you for free. But we're going to use guilt.
Guilt works. I mean, guilt absolutely works.
It's not democratic, though. It's fundamentally undemocratic. And that's part of the problem I have is that news, especially, I'm kind of the opinion all software should be free, that the paid software model is a broken model. And certainly social networks should all be free. And news should be free. You've got to find other ways to monetize it because it's undemocratic to say that only people who can afford news should be able to get the good news, and the rest of you are going to get fake news and crappy news and link-baity news. That's not right.
And yet when freedom of the press started, like everybody had to pay to get that cheat,
the broadsheet, right?
So
it's one of the reasons we've never charged
one person
for Twit.
Bought it. And then other people they shared it, talked about it, whatever, shared it around, So I think that
it's kind of the HBO model. Like we know people steal it, but some of you are going to pay for it and it all works out in the end.
The LA Times accidentally ran a new business model experiment without even realizing it. A couple weeks ago, their page loads times were like really, really slow and people couldn't figure out what was going on. And a friend of mine was poking around, and somebody was using their site to mine for bitcoins.
Oh my God!
So they had been hacked in a weird way.
Oh
but
my God!
Also, maybe like a genius way to raise some cash.
Yeah.
Right.
Just not for the LA Times, unfortunately.
And to close the loop on the Facebook thing, I do think Facebook is primarily over, and every under 30, there's hardly any people that are actively engaged on Facebook. So what's next is the important question. And for the hearings themselves, I think that you have to take what happened, not just in the event itself, which was somewhat sad and disappointing and not what it could have been or should have been, but think of it as a first step or maybe second step, right? Because they did call after the election a few of these tech heads before the Congress to testify. Again, it's about the scrutiny coming on to these folks about the way that they use data. And while this wasn't ideal, it wasn't what it could have been or should have been.
It's a start.
It is a start.
Yeah.
And you're going to increasingly in the coming years see more pressure on them to be transparent. And the Maryland legislation, I think, is another step in that direction. They're going to be more transparent about what data they take, how they use it, how much it's worth, and then what they can do to give people control of their own data.
Well, and somebody in the chat room brought this up, and maybe not in exactly this way, but also there's the possibility that a transparency here, I'm going to sell your data to marketers. You will see ads related to the things that you do on this platform. If you would like to not receive these ads, it will cost you $10 to use a month to use the platform.
Yeah. And I bet most people say, fine, I don't want
to pay it.
Yeah, I don't. Am I wrong? I don't have a problem with Facebook using my information to sell ads. That's not where the issue is. The issue is more using my mood to take advantage of me to sell ads, or selling my information to a foreign government, or using my information, you know, in kind of sleazier ways than just straight up. You talked about Jeeps. You should see Jeep ads. What would be wrong with that? You're actually interested in Jeeps.
They're taking more data than what they're telling us. The problem
they're taking more data, and they're using it in ways that are kind of not so nice.
And they're pushing the very
We're talking about what's already happened. I mean, you know, Facebook saying if at the end of all of this, the end result is we'll tell you, you know, we'll give you the opportunity to opt out so that we won't use your data to surface ads. It's sort of like not that that sort of shields us from everything that's coming. You know, the next social networks are going to be part of mixed reality, not text and photo and video based social networks that we have right now.
Now's the time that I get to work on social networks that don't rely on surveillance capitalism to survive. There must be some other way to create the next thing that doesn't require this kind of skeezy invasion of privacy. Or is that not going to
TwitBook?
Happen? TwitBook. I like it. Let me take a little break. I am so thrilled that you guys are here. Great, smart people. Amy Webb, the signals are talking. The Future Today Institute. Find out more at amywebb.io, W-E-B-B.io. Lindsay Turrentine, editor-in-chief at CNET. I mean, phew, that's power. That's power. She is also at L. Turrentine on Twitter.
Yeah.
And, of course, Jason Heiner from the Tech Republic and CBS, both CBS Interactive. And ZDNet. Thank you all for being here. I want to introduce a new sponsor. Not to this show, but not new to people who've listened to me talk about this app for months, because I love it. It's the front page of my phone. It's called Aptiv. A-A-P-T-I-V. And it is a trainer in your phone. Aptiv is audio-based workouts. You put them in your ears. Created by certified personal trainers. You get it on a mobile app. I love the trainers. There's a huge variety of trainers and a huge variety of training. Everything from riding a bike, taking a walk, getting on a treadmill, lifting weights. I have a medicine ball training I do on this thing. I just love great music, really good trainers for all personalities. I have a certain kind of trainer I like to use, somebody who kind of kicks my butt a little bit and says, work a little bit harder, but maybe you don't want that. There are more than 40 new classes every week in every kind of workout. You know, if you've been getting on a stair climber or an elliptical and just kind of doing it for 20 minutes and not seeing a lot of results, what if you put a trainer in your ear or on your speakers that said, okay, now I want you to step it up. We're going to do some high intensity. Now slow it down. You can even get yoga and meditation in this. Aptiv trainers guide you in a flexible audio format. It is a great way to make fitness a lasting part of your routine and a lot less expensive than hiring a trainer or going to the gym. Classes for all fitness levels, beginning, intermediate, advanced, more than 2,500 workouts. You'll never get to the bottom of them. And as I said, there's always new workouts, many more than you could ever take. Every music genre, every difficulty, every duration. And by the way, the Aptiv community is great. And they're working on their fitness goals, and they support you. You support them. It's very affordable. I got the year membership a couple of months ago, but you can start at $14.99 a month, $100 for an annual membership, and we've got a deal for you, 30% off. So if you've been looking at Aptiv, you can try it for free, and I would do that.
But $69.99, 30% off for a year of unlimited workouts. Aaptiv.com/twit. AAPTIV.com/twit. I've been using this for several months now. And it is just a great, you know, it, as the weather turns and you can take walks, you can use it to get out there and run. They can walk you through a run or a walk. Everything you could ever imagine. And you never have to repeat. You can always have a new workout every day. Aaptiv. I love it. AAPTIV.com/twit. I was really pleased because I've been giving them free plugs for months. I was really pleased when they said, hey, would you like to do an ad? I said, yes, I'd be glad to. We're talking, it feels like we've been talking about Facebook for the last 3 months. It seems like also one of those conversations that doesn't have a logical end. Like, I don't know what to say, what you could even say. We know we're not happy about it, but I don't think anything is ever going to change. So
we just have to keep putting pressure on them, you know, to be more transparent.
And what about Twitter? What about Google? What about Amazon? What about Microsoft? Are they going to skate? What? And by the way, there's more than 300 companies gathering information just like Facebook that you don't even know about. Not to mention your internet service provider.
Well, but they don't use it in the same way. They're not smart. And I mean,
take that back. Comcast, Verizon, AT&T have all sold information that they gain from you using their services to third parties. They also, as we know, are a revolving door for the NSA and spy agencies. They're glad to hand over all that information. Thanks to a whistleblower, we know that the NSA had a room in San Francisco's AT&T headquarters where they monitored everything on the internet and on the phone system.
I mean, I'd be more worried about them if they had, you know, 10,000 engineers working on machine learning, but they don't.
Well, that's true. Machine learning is a little scary because it's weaponizing this stuff.
And so...
Who are you more afraid of, government or industry? Business?
Oh, 100%.
Business?
100%. They
100% both.
Well, yeah, that's true. I'm scared. The commercial's more scary right now, especially because they have...
But see, I cannot use Facebook. I don't have to use Facebook.
Right. True.
I'm not moving out of the U.S.
There are some people who really do have to use it, though, for their jobs, or it is the primary way that they communicate. It's a free service. A lot of people now use Messenger.
Siva Vaidyanathan said that it's white privilege that allows us to quit Facebook.
It's some kind of privilege.
That might be going a little far, but...
There are plenty of places around the world where, for various reasons, press is being undermined. It's not free. So Facebook is the one way that they're able to publish, certain news. But here's what there are legitimate reasons why in some cases it works. But here's what I would say. Our entire future, if we are entering the third era of computing, and by the way, this is my entire next book is coming out soon, is all about this. So if we're entering the third era of computing.
Let's give us some background. What are the first two?
So the first was tabulation, and the second was programmable systems.
Okay.
So the third era is AI, which has been in some form of development for the past 150 years. So the challenge is that as we now move from, artificial narrow intelligence into what comes next, all of the primary research and work that's being done is all being done in the commercial sector. And so I in the book, I identify the big nine. There are nine big companies that basically control our future on Earth and any other planet and place that we may venture to. Three of those companies are in China. That's Tencent, Baidu, and Alibaba. And the other six are here in the United States. Google and Amazon are the primary ones that matter, followed by Microsoft, Facebook, IBM, and to a far lesser degree, Apple.
And what about Tesla? Seriously. And related Musk.
Sure. Tesla is not built. Tesla doesn't have all of the primary and basic research that's being done is not being done. Tesla is not one of the primary.
Waymo more than Tesla. Way more than Tesla.
But here's the problem. The problem is that these companies have fiduciary responsibilities to their shareholders, and they are profit-driven organizations. And even in China, technically, they're independent companies, but they are very much tied to the Chinese government.
Well, that's the thing that I'm very aware of is the fact that you could say Baidu and Tencent, but especially as she consolidates power
There is a definite move towards, for instance, putting, you know, Communist Party committees in these businesses, yeah, requiring investment of the Chinese government. They're basically, that's this right, is an article from Bloomberg. It's an opinion piece, but basically there's some evidence that they're effectively nationalizing the tech sector, and they certainly want to have a lot to say about artificial intelligence, and they are using it against their citizenry right now.
That's right. So just as an example, so there are two, SenseTime and Megvii are two enormous AI companies that most people haven't heard of. The former is now just got a $4.5 billion valuation last week, making it the most highly valued AI tech startup in the entire world. The AI ecosystem is predicated on data, on people. And so, you know, the reason that people say data is the new oil is partially because, it, like oil, it has to be mined, refined, and productized. But if you think about it in terms of us, we are the data, we are creating the data, then who's in charge of the largest natural resource going forward on Earth? It's China, with 1.4 billion people and totally different ideas and restrictions around how their data is used. So, you know, the needs and desires of these companies often run counter to the needs and desires and hopes of a democracy, not just in China, but in the United States. And so my argument is that we ought to change the developmental direction and track that AI is currently on. But that's going to force us all to make a lot of really difficult and possibly uncomfortable decisions. But if we wait 20 years, we're going to find that life is going to look really strange in ways that we don't like. And we have some agency and say in changing that developmental track now. We just have to decide we want a different future for ourselves.
I would argue that life looks really strange in ways we don't like right now.
Sure.
We're just waking up to it.
I kind of get up every morning and go, what is this?
Yeah.
This is so weird. But the other thing that I think needs to be mentioned, I think all of those points are so germane and smart. However, despite the size of the Chinese population, that value is only as good as the wealth held by the people who generate the data. Because presumably the data is used to manipulate the way that we distribute our own wealth. That's why the data matters so much.
The stuff we buy.
And in some cases, right, our choices, and that's why we're here talking about it, because of the elections. So there's also political power related.
In China, they're absolutely using this. They have the social score, and they're keeping you from buying houses, taking trains.
The social score
Amy, you're an expert on Asian cultural differences. That's a cultural difference that seems something that would be very hard to do here in the States, but seems to be becoming rampant in China.
Well, this is why you have to connect the broader dots. So all of this facial and posture, face recognition is interesting, but they're the world leaders in posture recognition. So it turns out everybody has a unique face print. We have unique fingerprints, but we also have unique face prints because the capillaries beneath our skin are all slightly different, right? We also have unique voice prints. So not just the particular intonation of our and cadence, right, when we speak, but all of the other elements that go into our voices. They're also leading the field in voice print recognition technology, and also posture and gesture. So, you know, you
is all you of this aimed at recognizing you with a camera, even
so,
if you're facing the other way.
Right. So you have to look at all that. China's also been developing smart cameras, which are capable of identifying and locking onto somebody and then handing off. I mean, you've seen this in the Bourne movies and on CSI, but this is a real thing, right, where the cameras can lock onto somebody and follow them without a human in the loop.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're not supposed to jaywalk in China. And if you do, that's frowned upon. Well, now they've used all of this technology that I just described to identify you. And at intersections, they have electronic billboards, and they will put your face up on the billboard and say, you know, Mr. Wong just, you know, jaywalked across the street. Here's where he works. Here's, you know, here's his job. They'll broadcast it out on Weibo, which is the Chinese version of Facebook. And make life generally pretty uncomfortable for that person. So it's not just about commerce, I guess is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, let me see if I can, and you can tell me if you agree with this, codify this a little bit. There's what Lindsay was talking about, which was using this information to manipulate people into participating in the economy more vigorously, spending more money.
Or potentially things like elections
or
and social choices.
Them, making social choices. And then there's what governments like to do, partly social choices, but mostly what a government is really all about is maintaining order, to maintain the status quo. I mean, let's be honest, that's all government has ever really been about, whether it's a king or a Congress, is maintaining the social order so that the people who got it can keep it. So, and both, you could have both of those. They're not mutually incompatible, as you point out, Lindsay. But from the point of view of an American citizen, they have very different import and means. Are there other ways, would you say, that this is being used besides social control and for economic purposes?
Yeah, I think I would like to give a shout out to the mayor of Louisville who says that cities and governments are a platform for human potential, or that's what they should
now,
be.
See, that's interesting.
I love that. I love that concept.
They can foster the population to be more actualized, more, you know, more efficient, more productive, happier.
Yeah,
that is a
exactly.
great vision.
I love that. That possible. So shout
so
out
that's,
to
so
Greg
it could
Fisher.
Go that way,
right.
Or it could go the other way.
Yeah,
well, there is another piece of this, which is that. So if AI is the next era of computing, everything else is layered on top of that. So I would argue that AI is not the most important technology going forward. The biology is the most important technology platform of the whole 21st century.
Well, we're about to enter this whole genomic revolution, aren't we?
Right. So that's why it's so important to look at all these different things and, you know, connect dots. Smart cities, Dubai and Saudi Arabia are both doing really interesting things to change the electric grid and to send power in new ways and, you know, optimize so that they're off traditional power sources, but that plugs into AI as well. So there's a vested interest in becoming the, you know, China's quickly becoming the global hegemon, which would mean that we're all much more reliant on China, not just for direct economic investment, but, you know, potentially for things like power or the soft robots that will live inside of our bodies.
And maybe this is a stereotype. Correct me if I'm completely mistaken. But my sense of Americans is we're rugged individualists. This nation was born on the notion of, I'm going my own way. I'm going to believe what I want.
You can put that billboard up on America. They'll be like, so what?
Don't tread on me.
I cross the street.
So, so what?
Well, I think that, to be fair, that depends on who you are.
That's true.
Like, rugged
that's
individualism, true. As long as you look like me.
Yeah, well, no, but that's part of it, too. We have to face it. America is a country that was built on slavery, and so there is a kind of an endemic history of racism in this country that we have to own up to. But
absolutely.
But there is this fundamental notion of the individual and individual rights, whereas I is this a complete stereotype, Amy, but I feel like China, because of Confucianism particularly, which really promoted the notion of society being the greater good. The individual is less important than society. Is that correct?
Well, that is very true in places like Japan and China and Korea. However, you know, there's 1.4 billion people in China, so not everybody's on the exact same page all the time about everything.
Yeah, and not all Americans are rugged individualists. Yeah. However, I think that the kinds of things we're talking about are anathema to rugged individualists and fit right into the worldview of a country where the society is paramount to the individual.
I think the thing with China we have to think of, too.
Do we want to live in a society like that? That's what I want to know. I don't.
You know, China has this important work they're doing in AI. Much of it is anathema to the values that that we have in the West in terms of privacy and our expectations of, you know, data security, all of these things. But we also have to remember that, you know, China is happy serving 1.4 billion people today. And the companies there and the society. So they're happy having a certain myopic viewpoint.
Collectivism has been very powerful for them.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that myopic viewpoint works for them. But it will get to a point where it will, they will, even if it works perfectly, which I think you still have. There are still a lot of people, to Amy's point, in China who are dissenters to that point of view of about you know, the government having such control over everybody's lives.
Which way is the world moving? Is it moving to collectivism or individualism?
I mean,
and what will these technologies do to
for
that?
A while.
You know, I would submit that the genomics revolution might move us more towards individualism, but that's going to really exacerbate the difference in the haves and the have-nots. If I can with enough money make sure my kids are smarter, faster, better than your kids, because
I've
got
money. But that's happening in
that's
China.
That's problematic.
That's happening in China. I think that we're some. It's like elective collectivism.
Oh boy.
And it's, I mean, we get really wonky here, but I feel like there's a way in which we are moving beyond the bounds of typical government. Because we're starting to build our own communities.
We need to save the planet. That may end up being so important that we have to abandon individualism.
Well, and it could be that we take our individual cultures, apply them across regional boundaries and physical boundaries. There's been a lot of sci-fi about this, right?
Yep.
But this idea that we start to form nations that have to do more with our ideologies and our interests than they have to do with our governments. And to a certain degree, social media is kind of allowing us to do that and to block out the ideas and interests of anyone else physically around us, which I think is super weird.
It's collectivism as long
it's
as
super
we
weird.
Don't pay attention to our neighbors.
I mean, the East and West are becoming more and more integrated, right? So the individualism and collectivism are going to meet and find a balance in there naturally, just by the fact that the world itself is becoming so much smaller. It's becoming so much more integrated. It's becoming so... influenced by one another. And that's where I was getting to with China is, while China is doing certain things with data today, eventually those companies are going to want to become global companies, and those standards and those ways of dealing with people and their users are not going to be acceptable globally.
Which companies? Are you talking about Tencent, Alibaba, and Baidu?
Yes, yes.
They are global companies.
Well, they are... But
well, are they? I mean,
in the same way that Google, Baidu,
Google's not global. Google's not
by revenue, by numbers. Absolutely not. Those by revenue and by numbers, those three companies are. You know, Alibaba is Amazon.
Yeah, but it doesn't have a presence in the West. Or
do they need to have? Well, so then the question has to do with how we are valuing these organizations,
right?
If these organizations are making as much or more in revenue, and if they have as much or more influence over their designated population, then what does it matter that they're not in every single country around the world?
What
it
I'm saying
matter.
Is eventually they'll want to be. You know, when I was there and I talked to them, I asked this question across the board because they have products, they have very compelling things they've done. They are innovating very quickly in a number of ways. And I asked them, in each one, and got a very similar answer. The question of, when are you going to bring this to Europe? What are you going to do in, in the U.S. and North America? And the answer at each case was, right now we're really focused on China, other than Huawei. Huawei is actually, and they've been at this longer as a global company.
It's the same thing, though, with Amazon, right? Amazon's really focused on the U.S. and to somewhat lesser degree
a little bit
Western
to sure, but I know Europe. But very
Alibaba
little.
Wants to be here so badly.
And I'm sure and Jeff I'm Bezos sure would love to be in China.
And we'll figure it out. I actually think it's more, I personally think it's more likely that Alibaba will end up here than Amazon will end up in China for regulatory reasons.
Right.
I don't know. Given the tension right now, I have a feeling that they'll get hit with regulation because the U.S. government will be concerned about IP bleed and our personal data bleed. I mean, I would say that we would have a national security interest in allowing Alibaba to gain a foothold in the United States, that would take some debate and discussion from a national security standpoint.
It's really unfortunate because currently this will change, but we don't have an administration right now that shows any clear
long-term vision. And you could just as easily see President Trump saying, yes, yeah, screw Jeff Bezos. Come on in, Alibaba. I mean, it's...
It could go any way.
Who knows what's going to happen.
And it could change entirely in 3 years.
But I can imagine also a time when we have almost a clash between the East and West, where you've got these economic interests centered in Asia and centered in the West, and they both want the other, and there's a massive clash between them. A new kind of economic warfare. Almost.
I think that's less likely. Because
Amy, do you think that's going to happen?
That would be the thing that I would be concerned about. And when Trump was going on and on, egging on China, not only was that a stupid he was making stupid economic arguments, but, you know, just displayed this culture, this deep cultural insensitivity. You can't challenge a Chinese man to a duel and think he's not going to show up. Right. You know, like that's not the way it works. So absolutely, the wars of the future, this is, and I can't say what I was going to say, so I won't. regarding some of the work that I do, which is
secret.
But here's what I would say. We think, you know, our reference point for war is always what we've always seen in the past or what we've seen in movies. It's hard for us to conceive of something as being realistic or plausible when we've never seen it before. My models and, you know, my work would show that the wars that we're potentially headed to in the future have different contours and aspects of them that are more economic in nature, but could be, you know, very disastrous.
There is, though, the argument to be made that free trade is good for peace. That when China relies on us for its economic well-being, and when we rely on China for our economic well-being, they're much less likely to wage war.
There's stability.
That's
right.
To be honest, you know, Trump standing up to China in trade is not he has some good points. Because we let every country in the world dump cheap goods here, and all of them are very strict about what goods they allow to go in. So, like, we're all about free trade. Everybody else is very circumspect about free trade, which means it's not really free trade. The problem was, you know, you do the embargo to make a point. And then China's response was very measured. It was like, look, we're not going to make a big deal about this. You did 50. They follow international laws. They're like, you know, you did 50 billion. We're going to do 50 billion. And then Trump comes back and says, well, we're going to do 100 million. And
so
it's
there.
Like, you just played into his hand. He like let you look like the bad guy,
right?
You know, and now you made it even easier for you to be the bad guy and everybody else, the rest of the world, to say you guys are the ones that are.
I hope,
you know,
that in years to come, there'll be a little bit more of a rational back and forth. I don't think right now we're in a rational period in the country. So I'm hoping that at some point.
That's what we were talking about at the very beginning. I wonder if it's possible for us to return to rationality because we've already been conditioned for craziness. Can we go back in the other direction? That's what we were talking about at the very beginning of today's show.
I think so. It's a pendulum swing, right?
Like, you're society, the futurist. I hope you're wrong.
Society is always a pendulum.
I was more just curious to see what you all think.
Is it possible?
Yes,
swing in the other direction.
It is.
It's absolutely possible because society is always a pendulum swing, right? And because humans have this grass is always greener mentality.
In fact, I would go a step farther and to say that just as there will be a flight from irrationality, having experienced it will be the best lesson of all. And then instead of conditioning us to irrationality, we will flee from it and we will seek hyper-rationality.
I hope so, but I am becoming convinced over time that humans are simply irrational because we're emotional creatures, and that's being played to, and that we may circle back or we may be charmed by a leader who speaks more rationally because it seems like an alternative. But the United States in which that happens may look completely different.
Sunday Driver says we're in the cray cray zone and we're staying there. Let's take a break. I want to talk tech. Wait, we got some tech stories. I'm sure we do. We'll find them. Just a second. I love the deep philosophic stuff, though. I really do.
And it's my favorite twit panel ever.
Well, I really love that. I hope we're not turning people off because it is kind of amorphous. But it is really, I think these are the thoughts, these are the things you might have to think about if you want to think about what our future is to look like. And if you're going to think about, well, what do we do about destructive social media? You've got to think on that larger scale of what its impact is and what is, more importantly, what is the world we want to live in?
Yes.
And I guess that's what I was kind of bringing up is what is that world? Is it the world of the rugged individualist? Is it the world of collectivism? Is there some third way? What is the world we want to live in? I don't know if we have enough of that conversation, you know, in general, in the body politic. I feel like that's an important conversation to have.
I think it's hugely important. And what I have noticed recently is that every once in a while, coming back to the original conversation about publishing, every once in a while, somebody on the CNET staff or CNET itself will tweet something or share something that is just positive. Just like, here's a great piece of news.
Well, you don't hear that very much anymore, do you?
Tell you how much appetite there is for that.
Yeah.
There's this like groundswell of excitement around something that is positive.
We get tired of that too, though.
We do. I mean, if it's Pollyanna-ish, if it bleeds, sure.
If it bleeds, it leads.
But I think that there is an appetite for optimism.
It's a good reminder, though, especially now when it feels like the world is crumbling and life is just happening at us. You know, we forget that we all have the capability and the possibility and the skill set and the tools to create the futures that we want. The future doesn't just show up fully formed. You know, we are creating it in the present. But we have to be willing to make some short-term sacrifices for long-term gain. And that's the challenge. The challenge is that we tend to think in the now in right. the United States, and we think in the now and, you know, sort of short shrift ourselves in the future. So, you know, I think it's a great idea for us all to be optimistic about the world that we're creating, but then we have to, you know, put the wheels in motion to make that optimistic future happen, which
well
we can
said.
Do.
Part of the problem well is I think we're living in the most affluent in general, for not for everybody, obviously, but in the most affluent times we've ever had, that most people, even relatively poor people, are living better than people have lived, you know, for millennia. And maybe the thing to acknowledge is how good we have it right now.
Global poverty is at an all-time low.
Violence all-time low. This is the book I've been reading, The Better Angels of Our Better Nature. It's Bill Gates' favorite book, right? Fascinating. It really is. It's a miraculous time we live in. And so
It
doesn't feel that way.
We've got unfinished work, right? We've got lots of unfinished work still. And we're more conscious about it, right? We see it because we know what good looks like. We're more conscious about the things that we see. And we see a lot of unfinished work that we have to do as a country, as a people, as a world.
I think there's also a sense when you're at the top that it looks like a long way down.
Sure.
Yep. And that when things are going really well, then the most predominant emotion is fear that you're going to lose it.
Sure. And we also, as humans, respond to fear. That's why if it bleeds, it leads.
Right.
Has been a truism for a long time. Right. But also, I think that we are so much more exposed through social media to what is going wrong. Even though we tend to personally give our rosiest visions of ourselves
on social
media. Yeah,
it's funny. Isn't Instagram just everybody's, you know, my
sure.
life is great?
But we are also very eager to share what's happening that's wrong next to us.
Yeah.
And we know when something bad happens to a friend. Yeah. We might know faster.
Even not friends. Just anything
anybody.
Bad happening anywhere in the world,
we know it immediately. And sometimes they're very specific stories. I don't want to say small, because nothing is small when something tragic is happening to you. But we learn about a lot of specific single stories that we might not have heard about before. Yeah.
In the future, in the past, you would have never seen that, right?
Right.
Like,
right.
You would
live
have
in
never
your little
been
village.
Conscious of.
You'd be aware of your neighbors.
The bad things that were happening in small ways to people.
Sure.
And who cares who's in the castle? You know, what does that mean to me? You know, as long as they don't raise my taxes. Amy Webb is here, the futurist. Her book, The Signals Are Talking. And what's the new book going to be called? When is it out? And when can I interview about it?
We're like on title revision number 3,
Secret.
But it's a manifesto about the future of AI written
Can't
for
wait.
Everyday people
Can't
out
wait.
Spring of 2019.
I have to wait a whole year. This really is important. I'm glad you're writing it.
Thanks.
And it is a conversation we have a lot here on our
Absolutely.
On our show.
Going to continue to have. It's not going to get any, it's not going to get any less important.
Nope. Jason Heiner, he's the editor-in-chief of Tech Republic. Lindsay Turrentine is also here from CNET.com, where she's editor-in-chief. I got the editors-in-chief here.
top brass. Our show today brought to you by, just take a, it smells good in here. It smells a little bit like cupcakes, but it smells good in here. That's because our air is pure. We are breathing filtered air through Molecule, the world's first molecular air purifier. We got our first Molecule at home because Lisa was getting stuffed up and headaches every morning from allergies. We live out in the country. We got a Molecule. Headaches were gone. In fact, I know it's real and not an imaginary thing because we had we were away one night and we had a relative staying in our house. He turned off the Molecule. I don't know why. We got home the next night. Lisa got a headache. She said, "What's wrong? Is the Molecule broken?" It was turned off. We turned it on. She's better again. It really works. Molecule is not a HEPA filter. That HEPA filter technology you've heard about has been used to clean your air since the 1940s. There haven't been any major innovations since until now. Molecule's PECO, P-E-C-O technology. It's photoelectrochemical oxidation. And it goes way beyond what a HEPA filter can do to capture and eliminate not just allergens, but stuff 1,000 times smaller than what a HEPA filter can capture. Mold, bacteria, viruses, VOCs, airborne chemicals. We actually got one in here because of paint fumes and then the smoke from the fires and then tar on the roof. It was really this. There's no windows in this studio, and this Molecule has saved our lives. Molecule makes it easier to cope with asthma and allergies, significantly reduces your symptoms. One customer said after using a Molecule in her home, she was able to breathe through her nose for the first time in 15 years. That was not Lisa, but it could have been. Molecule's technology, funded by the EPA, extensively tested by not only real people, but university laboratories like the University of South Florida's Center for Biological Defense. You can read all about this on the Molecule webpage. The University of Minnesota's Particle Calibration Laboratory. It's easy to use. It's beautiful. It's kind of like the Apple of air filters. It's a solid aluminum shell. And you can connect it to the internet. And when the filters get low, they'll automatically send you new filters. I love that. Although, I have to say, that doesn't happen. It's not even monthly. It happens every few months, depending, of course, on how dirty your air is. But we've only changed filters once in about 8 months, something like that. Some users have said that the Molecule is the one thing that's allowed them to breathe easy in their home. It's great for offices where, you know, windows are sealed and you can't open the windows. This fixes the sick air in offices. You don't have to use the Bluetooth or Wi-Fi if you're privacy concerned or whatever. It works just like a regular air freshener. It's got a button on the top. You turn it on and so forth. It has a silent mode. I really like that. We use that in the bedroom, so you don't even hear it. It's whisper quiet. But if you have a lot of air to clear, you can turn it on high and it'll... You will love the Molecule. I want you to try it. We've got $75 off your first order if you go to molecule.com. That's Molecule with a K, M-O-L-E-K-U-L-E.com, and use the promo code TWIT. Finally, technology has come to air purifiers. This thing is so much better than anything you've ever tried before. Molecule.com, promo code TWIT. And, you know, if you've got dangerous air in your house or your office, this is a really good solution. Molecule.com. Use the promo code TWIT at checkout. All right, let's see here. I have to admit, though, the Molecule does not get rid of cupcake smell. And this is driving me crazy.
That's a good thing.
It smells so good.
Maybe it just knows.
Oh, it's so good. It knows. Why would you ever want to get rid of that? Smell. It knows. All right, I'm going to try to find something upbeat, something happy, something fun, an antidote, and I can't. I can't.
There's nothing.
I can't. There's nothing.
There's
the HomePod, a flop. Is the HomePod a flop?
It's not setting the world on fire.
Not setting the world
for sure.
Mark Gurman, who's really got his finger on the pulse of Apple news and Bloomberg Technologies, say inventory is piling up. Low sales have pushed the company to cut orders with the company that's manufacturing the HomePod.
$199. It'll be dropped to $199 pretty soon. At $199, it's a lot more interesting than at $350.
People thought maybe if people can go to the Apple Store and listen to it, sales will go up. It had really good pre-orders, which just fell off the cliff.
You know, I have one.
I do too.
And you know, I think for me, I like it. It works because I already was invested in Apple
Music.
But I'm like the one.
It's the only.
Yeah.
You know, a
That's
Sonos.
It's a really, really expensive way to listen to your overpriced Apple Music, I think.
Thank you.
That is all true. However, I can corroborate it sounds great.
It does sound really good.
It sounds great.
Although.
We cracked one open on Tech Republic, which is also a CNET video. So it's a, yeah. And, you know, we talked about comparing the products during that. And, you know, better privacy because Apple's not very good at AI, among other reasons. But they also are committed to privacy. Like, they're really smart about this. They're like, look, we really stink at AI, so let's just double down on privacy. We're going to be the company that's all about privacy. We're not going to, you know, be the one that takes advantage of your data to monetize you. They weren't really doing that anyway, but whatever, you know, we'll give them some kudos. But the product itself is a good product. It just feels to me, it's too expensive at
$350. I think Apple tried to make it super luxury. We're going to make this fantastic sounding thing. It's going to have this luxury price like all, I mean, this is Apple to a T. We're going to launch later than others with something that we are going to tell you, and we really hope you believe, is better. And we're just going to keep telling you that it's better. But the reality is, in this particular case, it's not better enough. Not better enough, and Apple Music is the wedge.
Yeah. They can't come in and pick off what they love to do. They come in and pick off the most lucrative 10% of the market, right? And they're so good at it. And they're the place where all the money is made. They just come in and swoop that. It's just not happening.
Well, and the thing is that Sonos already did that.
That's true.
Like, if you go to the home of a wealthy person in the Bay Area, they are full Sonos. Room to room.
Yeah.
And Sonos has its own problems as a business.
I think the problem is that the big tech companies didn't see this coming. They didn't see Amazon's smart speaker coming, and they didn't see it in a meaningful way. So, you know, Microsoft is still trying to get a smart speaker to market. And they're late to market. Apple was late to market. And yes, you could say that was their strategy. There's always been their strategy. But, you know, in this economy, you're going to have to provide some seriously amazing value for a product that, you know, like Amazon, you can now get like a sub $50 version, right?
It sounds terrible.
It does.
I would say but you can also, Google Home Max, which most blind testers say sounds better than the HomePod, by the way. It's a little more expensive.
But it's as big as this table.
That's
it's
not that big.
And it depends on where you're sitting in the room. And
That's part of the problem is that Apple design, and this is actually, I just read a really interesting article. Apple designed a speaker that sounds good no matter where you sit. It's the tweeters go all the way around it, and the subwoofer fires straight up. That's fine in an environment where music is wallpaper, but if you're going to sit in front of speakers, the Max actually sounds better.
And the real question is, is Apple's closed ecosystem model going to survive going forward?
Not for music.
Part of the reason,
I don't think it is for music and media. I think that it has been too slow to all sorts of media. And the same, Apple's trying to make big moves when it comes to Hollywood, when it comes to studio. It's late. It's well behind Netflix. It's well behind established providers of content, and that's where Apple's going to start to struggle.
It's not just the content though. So all the modeling that I've done shows that 50% of the interactions that people in the industrialized world have with machines will be so doing their voice between now and the next 5 years from now. So what that tells us is that, you know, and this isn't like earth-shattering news, but we're moving into these zero-based UIs where we're speaking to, you know, talking is the new typing. So
that
talking
feels pretty
is the new
high,
typing.
Though, Amy. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, here's the argument that I'm laying out. The speakers are just the beginning of this. So having a speaker that connects to your phone to do certain things is useful right now. But the real question is, what does that ecosystem look like as it matures? Because we could very well be heading into, instead of, are you a PC or a Mac? You know, are you Amazon or...
That's right.
You know, probably
even
not
Microsoft
IBM.
Is recognizing that it's not about Windows versus Mac. It's about cloud. It's about services. It's about voice, the platform. We're seeing a complete sea change in how technology manifests in our home. And I think, Amy, what you're talking about is ambient computing.
Sure. I mean, I call it zero UI. There's conversational, ambient, whatever you want. But the fun, you know, speaking to and having other adjacently related, so like machine reading comprehension. So Google, this Ray Kurzweil at TED this week debuted a new product, you know, the Google search through books, you know, have a conversation with books.
Wasn't
product.
That interesting? He said instead of searching for keywords, we're searching for ideas now.
Right. Except that that's an example of something called machine reading comprehension, which within, you know, that's not earth-shattering brand new ideas or technology. And in fact, Microsoft and Stanford were working on that a while ago. But what's different here is that this allows us to have more of a conversation, right? So you're, rather than getting a bunch of links returned, machine reading comprehension, which is what that project is an example of, allows us to have those conversations with the devices. So this just brings me back to the speakers. So it's like, okay, great. Apple has an expensive speaker that sounds really good playing music in a particular circumstance. But going forward, which, you know, as the ecosystem matures, you know, Apple's going to have to do something besides make a cool product that connects to your iPhone that plays music pretty well, given that its whole ecosystem is locked down and closed. And everybody else, you know, Amazon is inside of cars now. Amazon is inside of banks. You know, Amazon has this massive open platform.
Well, to be fair, Siri is inside of cars too.
Yeah.
I don't think that most audiences understand the difference that you're talking about. And I mean, as a person who covers consumer technology day in and day out and sees how consumers respond to things, Apple has a chance with HomePod and any other AI, as long as Apple can find the thing that people don't know they need to solve yet. But look at, you know, Nest. Like, why did Nest beat all other connected thermostats? They existed before. It wasn't a new thing. They made it look good and they made it easy and they identified that something needed to be fixed. Now they've had problems since then, and they're losing
ground. Because nobody wanted to spend $400 on a thermostat that didn't do significantly anything more better than the existing.
If HomePod could solve a problem that we don't know
and
needed
literally,
to be solved,
and really solve it, not just on the surface solve it.
Sure,
I do think that. I just want to pick.
By the way, that's a big
name.
If. That's a hard thing.
It is a hard thing.
Oh, totally. I just think it can be done.
That's
it
basically
can be done.
Build a better mousetrap. And the world will beat a path to your door. Well, yeah.
But that keeps happening. That keeps happening.
But also, it happens from unexpected quarters. It's rarely the incumbent that comes up with the next thing, right? It's always...
I want to talk about voice, though. I want it for just a second. And zero UI, as Amy characterized it, and sort of ambient interface and all that. Because there's part of this that I feel like gets missed and gets overstated. And that's, I see a lot of these estimates, Amy, similar to like, you know, 50% of all computing is going to be with, you know, with your voice in the future. And I take issue with that for a couple.
Well, I didn't say computing. I said interactions with devices, which is not like the kind of computing that you're doing with the laptop that you've got sitting in front of you right now.
But this is why I prefer the term ambient, because what's happening, and so you can see this, it's moving from the center to the edge, computing moving to the edge.
Right.
And the idea that everything has some smarts and you interact with it in a natural way. Sometimes that's voice. Sometimes it's tapping your ear. Sometimes it's that the thermostat has intelligence. And to me, that's why ambient computing is a better definition. Certainly, we will use speech, but it won't be. It's not what we're talking about as this is the future of computing.
Right.
The future of computing is computing. Those cupcakes will have processors in them.
They'll have their own interface. So that I like better because, you know, these things we naturally train our users, right? Because certain users that are new to computing, and there are still a lot of users that are still just on the on-ramp, right? And some of those simpler interfaces appeal because it is a better on-ramp. But as those users become more sophisticated and complex, they tend to become more what we think of today as like power users, right? And they don't want to use a voice interface. They don't want to use the sort of the dumbed down interfaces. They want to use the ones where they can be more efficient.
Here's what I would say. That is based on what will soon be an outdated paradigm that we have to adjust to the computer, that we have to adjust to the interface.
Yes.
What I am hopeful for, we haven't gotten even close to it yet, but I'm hopeful for is an interface that adjusts to us. And that we operate in whatever, however we operate, and this would be critical for ambient computing to work, we operate as we would, and that the technology is smart enough to respond to us appropriately We don't have to adjust ourselves.
So last year I was interviewing Mark Spates, who's a head of product for Google, and he works a lot on all the Google Home implementation, all of their smart home, if you want to call it that, work. And he said exactly what you were saying, and that he thinks that the future is all in anticipation of needs and preemption of those needs, and it's not necessarily voice. And the examples that he would give, I don't remember the specifics, but really surrounded what we expect to have happen in our home based on our patterns, and then have that happening without a lot of interaction from us, simply through anticipating our needs. So to take this all the way back to HomePod, if Apple were able to create a HomePod that, even though it costs $350, when I walked in the front door said, you know, hey, Lindsay, glad you're home, started playing what I was listening to in the car without me asking it to. Ask me if I wanted to relock the doors or keep them open, reminded me to do whatever it is that I always forget to do when I get home, that may be charming and useful enough to me
and here's
that
why,
I want it.
Here's why it won't happen from Apple, because Apple is the king of the silo, and interoperability is exactly the opposite of what Apple's looking to do. And so that would only work if you had an Apple car and an Apple music service, an Apple refrigerator. If that's going to work, it's going to more likely come from somebody like Google.
Absolutely.
That is more open to the idea of having everything work
what
together.
What is the name of the...
This is holding Apple back, frankly.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. There's a name for this concept that organizations often create products that look like their organization.
Yeah, true.
So the old-fashioned example of this is that you would... If the stereo on the dashboard seems totally isolated and uninteroperable, if that a word, with the rest of the car, that's usually because a different department designed that. There's a totally different department within that auto manufacturer who designed that, and that the physical product ends up reflecting the organization's organization.
That's really cool. I don't remember
the name of it, but I'm going to Google the heck out of it, just like Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah, that's interesting.
When I get out of here, so that I can share it with you.
You should use the new Google Talk to Books. Maybe it could help.
Maybe. But it is a really interesting concept, and I think that's what you're seeing happen with Apple and what you're not seeing happening with Google.
That's very interesting.
Google has historically been very good at moving people around within its organization over time.
Break that up.
Right? Like, so you go into the Google HR organization and end up doing content at YouTube, and then you end up moving over to a different part of Google.
That's conscious.
And then Google ends up becoming less bifurcated as a result because its organization is a little bit more organic.
I think that's going to be a problem. It was a problem at Microsoft. It's going to be a problem at Apple, is this kind of inward looking. And you can even see it in the metaphor of Apple's spaceship campus, which is inward looking and is a barrier to the outside world versus something like Amazon's downtown headquarters in Seattle, which is integrated in with the city of Seattle and is part of Seattle. I find that fascinating, this whole notion of a company reproducing its own bias.
And
I think that's really, it makes a lot of sense. And it is something maybe that's really starting to harm Apple. It's one of the reasons Siri hasn't really excelled. This talk to books thing, see, what I feel like is that we're in baby steps mode, and that what we're seeing is slow. You know, one of the reasons, for instance, that we don't like voice assistants is we have to learn a peculiar syntax. We have to learn how to ask them for what we want.
The same way you used to have to learn a command line.
Yeah.
Right?
And it's not, what it needs to do is artificial. It needs to understand what we're saying. It needs to be HAL 9000. Well, that's a bad example, but it needs to, it better not lock the pod bay door, but it needs to understand it needs to intuit what we're looking for. And I feel like this talk to books is interesting. Did you think, Amy, that this was not compelling, or?
Well, I mean, Ray is compelling when he speaks, but the project itself is just an example of something called machine reading comprehension. So right now, Google's gotten pretty good at semantic search. You type in a search or you speak a search, and it may or may not give you the answer that you're looking for. But that's different from asking a question like, can I roller skate inside? I don't know.
I've asked talk to books, which will triumph, collectivism or individualism? And actually, came up with some pretty good responses, including Ayn Rand's Fountainhead, the Oxford Handbook of Emotion, Social Cognition, and Problem Solving, Saving Face in Business, and Cultural Differences in a Globalizing World.
Speaking of advanced Googling, before I forget, I found it.
Oh, good.
It's called Conway's Law.
Oh.
And I'll read it to you. This is a law, and it's an adage named after computer programmer Melvin Conway. I'm reading off of Wikipedia. It was dubbed Conway's Law and states that organizations which design systems are constrained to produce designs which are copies of the communication structures of those organizations.
I love that.
As an editor, I would say that those witches should have been thats, but other than that, it's really interesting.
That's really interesting.
Well, it's probably a Britishism or something like that. Isn't that really interesting? Yeah. I wonder if it holds true. I mean, 1967, I really wonder if it holds true. Eric Raymond, who is, of course, well-known among open source advocates, restated Conway's Law in the New Hacker's Dictionary. He said, the organization of the software and the organization of the software team will be congruent. The software team and the software itself will be congruent.
Mm-hmm.
If you have four groups working on a compiler, you get a four-pass compiler.
But I think
tell you,
really
this is a really good argument for biodiversity.
Diversity. Thank you.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, unless you're only, and here's the mathematical explanation for that. If you are only selling your product to like white dudes makes, make up only a certain percentage of the total population, which means that, you're addressable. You're only addressing a tiny fraction of your addressable market.
Although as a white dude, I'm pretty happy about that. That's why I love software so much. It's divine for us, by us, right? FUBU. Here's Nigel Bevan, a usability expert. His version of Conway's Law: organizations often produce websites with content and structure that mirrors the internal concerns of the organization rather than the needs of the users. I don't know. It feels right to me.
Yeah, there's something there.
Feels right to me.
In some personal experiences I've had, I say absolutely.
Yeah.
That happens.
And it's completely unconscious.
And sometimes you can look at, and I love to use the dashboard example for this, but you can look at a dashboard and be like, why on earth does this knob exist over here when really it should be over here? It's probably because that team was working over here.
Yeah.
There's AirPods, a team for that knob.
They were over there.
AirPods follow Conway's Law. AirPods, I can guarantee, I don't know who exactly was on that design team, but I can guarantee, I would feel very confident that it was not a woman with curly hair, not a woman with long hair.
Very good point.
And
there's one size fits all, and my wife, who has smaller ear holes, I can't wear AirPods, they're uncomfortable.
Yeah, they don't fit, they fall out of my ears.
Yep.
The Apple earphones in general fall
most
out of my
other,
ears. If you have a small,
it's like, a problem for a lot of people.
Most other companies who make earbuds, with the exception of Apple, will give you multi-sized rubber things. And Apple's the only one, whether it's their iPhone AirPods or the AirPods, that's it. It better fit. If it doesn't fit,
I have yet to see.
You must get over it.
I travel a lot for work. And so I'm seeing more and more people walking around airports and walking around cities with these things in. And they're all men. I really haven't seen women wearing them yet.
I've never seen a woman in an airport with AirPods.
Oh my gosh, I see it all the time. I'm sorry.
Really?
Because I am fighting it. I think they do fit me, but I just can't do it.
Because it looks so bad.
And I realize that that's a bias that I'll probably get over time because so many people are wearing them. But I was actually in the airport last week actively looking and being like, look at all those ladies wearing AirPods. So maybe it's shifting or I don't know.
I'm going to look when I go to SFO. When I'm flying back, I will
does feel like a pathology of a company, though, that can't see beyond. It's actually been a problem in the computer industry since day one that the engineers designed products they understood, but that normal people didn't understand. Mm-hmm. That they were really by engineers for engineers. And now it's by white male engineers. I think that that's
I think
that's
outside
a
of the gender, outside of the gender and diversity thing, though, doesn't that sort of, I don't know, I keep finding it so interesting that in a lot of ways our technology has gotten more and more complicated and we have fewer and fewer user manuals.
Yeah.
You're just sort of expected to understand how to use stuff.
Yeah. I was talking about this on the radio show today because, on the radio show, I talked to normals and they are in great pain. It's not getting better. Mm. We always thought, it's the infancy of technology. It'll get easier to use. It'll be, it's not getting better. It's getting far worse. And now people are struggling with trying to keep Windows secure over a network and they're adding Internet of Things devices
that are themselves insecure. Their routers are misbehaving.
Oh,
nothing
man. Routers
works right.
Are the next frontier. Routers.
Your printer won't print.
Routers.
You can't change the channel on your TV. Nothing. It's a maze of complexity that is not serving people at all. I understand how people might just get fed up and
sorry. This reminds me of something else about China, though. One of the reasons that China does have a big advantage over America in AI and other fields right now is they don't have as much of a gender gap.
It's a monoculture.
No, it's like they're close to 40 to almost all their companies are close to 40 to 50% female, all the big companies, and their engineers.
That's interesting.
And so
they're in leadership positions.
That's really interesting.
In leadership positions as well. Not as
And they start young.
Yeah.
They start young. There are schools popping up all over the country where kids are like AI schools for kids.
How did they do that? Did they make a conscious effort? Was it the communist
math? In math.
That's right.
Yeah, the men and women compete, are equally skilled. There's no stigmas, and it really starts with math.
So it was cultural.
Well, and need for a workforce. I mean, the Chinese have a huge workforce. Yeah.
So if you think about it in terms of, you know, in the U.S., if we're maxed out with the amount of males, which may be that, you know, can go into tech fields, right? We're not nearly maxed out in our capacity and our available labor of women to go into and hold those positions.
This is great. And I had no idea.
And so because of that, and that's the best argument that I've even been able to use on people who are real, either threatened or skeptical about the gender gap in the U.S. and of like, look, we're losing because we're not mobilizing enough women. And so, of course, you know,
we're fighting with one arm tied behind our back.
Exactly.
Right. 100%. And it's not just diversity for diversity's sake. I mean, again, like this is an easy argument to make with numbers. So you've got half the population. So you're sort of plausible scenarios are either that half of the population is on the right side of the bell curve towards the end, meaning that they are the most smart and the most capable, which is statistically unlikely, right? Or the other alternative is that we've lopped off, you know, a good chunk of our best and brightest. And China has taken the attitude that, you know, gender sort of doesn't matter. That they're just looking for the best and the brightest, and to push them as hard as they can to achieve global dominance.
Wow.
You know, I mean,
so important note in the China U.S.
really,
debate.
This has been an education. This show, I gotta say, I am sorry, but I have to interrupt. We have to take a break. Keep those brilliant thoughts coming. We're not done yet. But I did want to show you, we made this little movie. It's really cute. I really wanted to show you from the week of things that we did this week on TwitWatch.
Previously on Twit.
Oh, I love that.
Well.
Your foil cap.
It's my tinfoil hat.
That's fantastic.
I'm a paranoid nut job.
I don't think paranoid nut jobs admit that they're paranoid nut jobs, so you're fine. You pass.
Even paranoids have enemies.
The new screensavers.
This is the ink display.
Yes.
Beautiful display. It's about 3/4 of an inch thick. Is it? Can I call this a smart license plate?
You can.
Calling server?
Yes.
Why is it? What's it doing?
It's going to change.
You've got the new sticker and you got the California background.
I think you've got a handle on the future. I mean, I can really see that this at some point becomes kind of required, right, for things like this.
This Week in Google.
This is it's the new doorbell from the Alphabet company, Nest.
This is my family coming home right now. Is that a balloon?
That's a balloon.
It is a balloon. It's my birthday
it's
balloon.
It's a Mylar balloon.
I just spoiled their birthday balloon.
You don't have to tell them. You invaded your own privacy.
Wait, did we see a cake? Hold on.
No, stop looking. Stop. Stop.
Twit, the happiest place on earth.
Whoa! Stolen?
Yes.
How does it know?
Well, if it's detached from the vehicle.
I like this.
That's really cool. I didn't see that.
Only in California. But
are they legal? Are they being used?
They're legal in California, Arizona. Many states are looking at it. There's actually a lot of good reason for the state to adopt it. They're not cheap. They're hundreds of dollars right now.
Sure.
But they make more of them.
Wow.
It could do all sorts of interesting things. They worked with California and the California Highway Patrol to make sure it was, you know, compliant with everything the CHP needed.
It can actually put advertising, but not while you're driving, only when you're legally parked.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's meant to be a replacement for your license? Like, that's where it goes with your... Yeah, of course, so then you're just like... So that's amazing, but then also, like, you're being tracked at literally every...
Oh, yeah.
Now you're being tracked by your mobile and your car.
Oh, yeah, it's got tracking.
But all I can think about is weather. Yeah. Like, what happens when I get wet? What happens when it gets hit?
Nope,
I
mean, it's IP67, waterproof. When it gets hit, well, it gets hit, but so does your car. I mean,
yeah, but bumpers are for bumping.
Well, when I was in Israel...
My car bumpers are not for bumping. I just want to say... Most cars nowadays, when it
might be,
you might have like a big rubber thing on your car, but nowadays cars collapse. you tap them, they go
break. Yeah, it's true. I had a bumper that broke lately. I was in Israel last month though, and they've
drive a bumper car.
They've instituted a pin. Every car has a pin in it, so you not only I rented a car, and they're like, here's your pin. Which this is really interesting. You know, the Israelis are so practical because they had a problem with theft. And so they were like, this is your PIN for the car. And they're like, you can't take that. Just take your phone out and take a picture of it. You know, and I'm like, okay. And I take the pictures. Like, yeah, when you get in the car, you gotta
enter the PIN.
You gotta enter the you put the key in, and then you have to enter the PIN, and then and then it lets you.
And also, if you're drunk, it's hard.
And so, that's true. Yeah. It does make it difficult.
You know, it is really. This is a little bit of a tangent, but it's really hard to debug cars. I drive the Lexus CT200H, which is no longer made.
Very nice car.
Which is very sad. It's it's Lexus's baby. Junior hybrid tiny car.
Yeah.
It's built on the Prius drivetrain, and I'm leading you up to something, which is the key fob in my car and some combination of those things has this bug in which everything's fine unless somebody who drives a Prius gets in my car with their key fob.
What?
Yep. And then
That's
my car thinks that my keys aren't there anymore.
That's
It'll be like
bug.
Keys not in the car. If my car engine is going, it will keep going. But if I haven't started my car yet, I actually have to make that person take their key fob out of the car.
I need you to get out of the car.
Yeah, I need you to get out of the car.
Because the Prius has priority.
The Prius apparently has priority. And this is not, I have a friend who has the same car, and it happens to her car too.
So they've, Lexus
and her car
has had
is many
bug.
Years newer than mine.
Wow.
So Lexus has had this bug for a long time and not fixed it. It is
case
super weird.
Of the pious Prius.
The pious Prius.
Our show today brought to you by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. When you buy a house, you have a choice. You really do. You can go with the bank, which will treat it like, hey, welcome back to the 19th century. You got to put on a tie, a nice dress, go into the bank, say, please, sir, can I have some money? He'll look through it's Dickensian. He'll look through a sheaf of papers. Well, I think you might qualify for this rate right here. They'll give you a big stack of papers to fill out, an application form. You'll go back home. You'll have to go to the attic. You'll have to find pay stubs. You'll have to find bank statements. You'll probably have to call your bank saying, do you still have my bank statement from 5 years ago? Do you? You'll have to find a fax machine so that you can fax this stuff to Oliver Twist back at the office. It's nuts. Or you can go with the future. You can go with Quicken Loans, which is not only the biggest lender in the country, they're the best. Number one in customer satisfaction, 8 years in a row, according to J.D. Power, and the most highly technologically savvy. Dan Harmon and his crew have always been. I mean, they're really amazing. They're revitalizing downtown Detroit. Quicken Loans, amazing company. And they realized that there was a better way because guess what? Here in the 21st century, we have the internet. We have computers. So they created Rocket Mortgage. You don't have to go to the bank. No, you can do this on your phone. You whip out your phone. Go to rocketmortgage.com/twit2. You don't even need a Rocket Mortgage app. I like that. Just do it in your browser. rocketmortgage.com/twit2. Answer a few simple questions you already know the answer to off the top of your head. They go out because they have relationships with all the financial institutions. They're Quicken Loans. They go out with your permission, get the information they need, crunch the numbers, and then based on income, assets, and credit, they will analyze all the loans for which you qualify for. Give you the choice. You choose the rate, the term, the down payment. It's completely transparent, and you're approved. And all this took 10 minutes, less. 10 minutes. Like, you didn't even have to get up off the couch. You could do this in an open house. RocketMortgage.com/twit2. The next time you're going to buy, or if you want to refi, they do refis too, go to RocketMortgage.com/twit2. You'll apply simply. You'll understand fully. You'll mortgage
confidently. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030. Bookmark it, rocketmortgage.com/twit2. Or, you know what, even better, just go there and start the process so that you'll be ready. And if you go to open house tomorrow and you see something you like, boom, you're minutes away from a home loan. You can show the realtor. It says here, we're approved. Rocketmortgage.com/twit2. We thank them for their support of Twit. This is depressing. 80% of teenagers prefer iPhone to Android. 80%. And, by the way, that's up from 78% last fall. And 84% of teens say their next phone will be an iPhone. 84%.
I wonder if that has to do with their parents, though, and not them, right?
Because there's hand-me-downs, right? So their first phone might have been a hand-me-down.
Right. So, you know, if that's been their only experience, and Apple's been so big in schools that they're more likely to encounter an iPad or an Apple product than a...
I don't think that's true. No. Chromebooks are winning in
much
schools,
bigger,
by
yes.
the way. Chrome much. Is huge everywhere, in schools. Everywhere. Chromebooks, just Chromebooks.
I think it depends on the school and the school systems.
No, actually, stats bear this out. It is...
It's a class thing.
School district we go to are looking at Chromebooks. A few are looking at Windows
Apple's
machines.
Education... thing and, didn't change the
no.
I mean, they're trying,
and
but
then
not yet.
So iPads do really well in like K-3 kids that are just coming in, right? Motor skills are an issue with keyboards in those ages. Apps are often very customized for those ages really well. But once they get into, you know, elementary school, Chromebooks winning big time. The only place that we see Apple making any headway is in private schools, where in high schools, they'll do Chromebooks up through eighth grade, and then in high schools, they'll do Macs.
To what do you attribute, then, this kind of complete dominance of Apple in America?
I think that the hand-me-down issue is a huge one. I think you're right, sure. And I think the hand-me-downs are a big part of it. So adults,
but that would say that 80% of adults would be using iPhones, too, which I don't think is
the
case.
I don't think so, but also... kids,
peer pressure with friends.
Peer like, pressure, the cameras... Yeah. And I do think that there's...
I think kids say, you're using a Samsung? Ew.
I don't know. I mean, again, this is... parents always do this, so I'm going to apologize and then do it. We always are like, well, my kid.
Right.
And so my kid...
Well, she's sitting right there, so it's okay. You're allowed.
She may have taken a break.
She left.
She got bored with me.
She said, I don't want to hear about it. Go ahead.
No. My son is 14, and he has a little bit more agency over his own choice, and he has a Pixel.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Good for him.
And that's what he wants. And he's like, I don't want those blue bubbles. I don't want you to know when I'm typing. That's very much him. But I do think that the Find My iPhone ubiquity is what has driven parents to get iPhones for their kids. Because even though there are apps to do that on Android, it's easy to do. It's easier to do it with a closed ecosystem of iPhones in your family to know where your kids are and track them. And I think parents love that.
Wasn't there a study very recently that showed the decline of Apple among kids is not seeing that as like a cool brand? I'm trying to find it.
Yes, but, and it's not true.
Yeah, I think...
or at least they're not putting their money where their brand is.
You know, kids are more fashion conscious, right? Especially at that age.
An
iPhone
is
like
a fashion
statement. One of the biggest things you think about is what you look like and what you brands you wear and things like that. And, you know, an iPhone is a brand that is just like fashion, you know, in among... kids. Now, that said, those things change quickly, and you know, you have to expect that at some point, you know, brands all run their life, have their life, you know.
Is there any chance the kids know that iPhones are more secure and more private and that they
no
doubtful.
nope
doubtful.
Also, you know what, I will
spoken as parents
argument,
by the way
make the argument that they don't care.
They don't care.
I think that for a lot of teenagers...
Wait, they don't care about their privacy?
Correct. That ship has sailed. They don't...
They know they're not private.
They know... They're like, yeah, I know that everybody's spying on me.
I think they care deeply about their privacy from their parents. I think they care deeply about privacy from certain cliques and kids at school.
Personal privacy. But talking about the kind of privacy we were discussing at the beginning of this show, right? Data privacy, I don't think they have any expectation of that.
Dana Boyd... says it's complicated.
It's never easy. It's interesting.
She makes it her business to study teenagers and privacy. And you're right. You're both right. She says teenagers understand how, you know, they aren't living privately. But at the same time, they do many things to obfuscate. You know, they don't use their real name on Facebook.
They all have many different Instagram accounts, and they only tell their parents about one of them.
Yeah. So I think her main point, I hope I'm not misstating it, but I think her main point is that young people don't think about privacy the same way as we think about privacy.
Remember when a couple months ago Facebook was launching a product for kids?
Yeah. Facebook Messenger. Remember for the under that? 13 set. Boy, that, wonder what happened to that.
That really is. They're not talking about it very much right now.
Yeah. We can't really get those. Everyone. Get those kids.
Yeah, expand the IDSK.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just kind of amazing how quickly we live our lives these days where, you know, if you remember that debate was raging on and on and on, and it's like everybody's forgotten about it already.
Boyd says, I've been overwhelmingly told kids these days don't care about privacy, and yet when I wandered around talking to young people, I found young people care deeply about privacy, even in an online environment, but how they strive to achieve that privacy is sometimes puzzling to outsiders. In other words, I think a lot of us look and say, well, you're using Snapchat nonstop. What do you mean? What is the privacy? They want privacy from authority figures, parents, teachers, social workers. They don't need privacy with their peers.
Well, the thing is this is very much the way it was, you know, when previous generations, before there was social media, you went to school and kind of what you did at school and said at school, most of it kind of stayed there, right? It was your sort of world. It was your kind of bubble. Right. And there's a little bit of a healthy part of that is right. It's kids.
Unless your parents were both teachers at your school.
Well, that's,
rough.
That is rough. If you know, kids have that little bit of space because it's part of them developing their own identity, developing their own sense of self. And in a social media world where everybody's aware of everything you're doing, right, they do lose that. And so you have to look at it in one sense of them recreating it in the world that we live in. And that's a natural part of them establishing their own identity.
I love this story. Apple sent out a memo to employees saying, you know, you got to stop leaking information. And in fact, last year we caught 29 leakers. 12 of them were arrested. The memo said these people not only lose their jobs, they can face extreme difficulty finding employment elsewhere. I mean, this was a thinly veiled threat. They pointed out that you could be prosecuted using federal laws against network intrusion. You could face jail time, be convicted of a felony, and of course the memo was immediately leaked.
What's the difference between, like, what I wonder what the line is, and I don't know the answer to this, but what's the line between whistleblowing, right? Leaking and whistleblowing and it, like, committing acts of corporate espionage? Mm.
We may find out. There's a Google employee who was dismissed because he released a memo that was a corporate memo, and he released it to the public. It was caught. I don't know. These companies are very smart about how they catch people.
Yeah.
And now he's suing, saying this is wrongful termination. You are violating my free speech. But I wonder how a court will react to that. I don't think you have a right to free speech inside a company.
No.
There's corporate secrets. Yeah. But you raise a good point. We also... Courts also have to protect the right of somebody to be a whistleblower, to release
that.
It may come down, you may be right. I think that's really an interesting question, and it may come down to intent. Why did you leak it? Did you leak it because you just like being part of a rumor mill? Did you leak it because you want to feel important? Or did you leak it because you think that there's something seriously going wrong at the company where you are and you've tried to deal with it internally? Nobody has taken it seriously, so you go to the press.
Is there any other moment in history when I feel like 2017, 2018 will partially be remembered as like the time we leaked? Is there other times in history where it was like this prevalent? Are there any, I can't think of any like other analogous times.
Are you talking about governmental leaks? Or are you talking
just
about
like people, which I guess is part of just being alive in the age of social media.
Yeah. We just have better ways to leak.
We can leak all over the place.
I try not to, but
unless you're getting scraped on the back end.
Yeah, well, sometimes it's hard not to leak if you're getting scraped on the back end. Here's in the Apple memo. I love this. In many cases, we understand, writes Apple. Leakers don't set out to leak. Instead, people who work for Apple are often targeted by press, analysts,
I love this part.
Who befriend them on professional social networks like LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook and begin to pry for information. While that may seem flattering to be approached, it's important to remember you're getting played.
I laughed out loud when I read this.
Well, I have to think, what's also funny is you could write this to members of the press, analysts and bloggers who receive calls from Apple executives.
Oh,
just remember,
gosh.
It might be flattering to get a call from an Apple executive, but you're getting played.
Oh my! I read half that stuff on those stories on the Wall Street Journal.
They're
and
getting
I'm like,
played.
I'll give you a good example.
Apple leaks all the time intentionally to the Wall Street Journal.
All the time. I think
that's Mark Gurman.
Conversation with the CEO, recently. They were talking about how, does Apple ever actually leak anything to the press? And I'm like, they are notorious. I said, I'll give you an example. If you remember when the Apple Watch was first coming out, there were all these crazy analyst estimates. They're going to sell 30 million in iPhones in, I can't remember what year it was, 2015 maybe when it came out. It was like, there's no way. You looked at even like the numbers of Fitbits and other things, and it was going to be a super set, right? It's a luxury version of that. And it was like, there's no way. And then all of a sudden, about a month before it was going to come out, there was the story in the Wall Street Journal about Apple reportedly has this internal memo that they only expect to sell 11 million
lowering
or something like that. I was like, they're leaking
that
because they want
to
lower expectations so that they can define what success looks like.
In fact, those of us who cover Apple pretty much can tell immediately from a Wall Street Journal headline 100%. Whether this is Apple's spin on it. Or this is something, some digging that they've done.
Yeah, I felt like that, and maybe part of the reason it was leaked, that memo might have been, who knows, it might have been intentionally leaked as
Tim
a warning.
Cook leaked the memo!
As a warning to anybody else and at journalists, and we want to control our message, and you stop meddling with us.
Are they playing me?
29
and so
people.
That you can all see how seriously we take this.
29 people.
Out of 120, they have 123,000 employees, by the way.
29 people. Hey, 12 of them are arrested. The police came.
I mean, it is true that Apple is really focused on controlling its supply chain.
Yeah.
And what it says in that memo, somewhere in that memo basically says, essentially, if you leak what we're doing, then journalists get to say what we're doing instead of us saying it better.
Right.
Yeah.
And leave the leaking to us.
That is very important to them to control the message.
Well, of course, every company. Every company, right?
Especially Apple.
Especially Apple more than any.
They spend more time than any other company that I know crafting the way they're going to tell their story.
Yeah.
That's why they're better at it. I mean, they are frankly better at it at telling their story than other companies. And so that undermines them.
And they do have
their perspective.
Pet journalist Matthew Panzerino of TechCrunch invited back to Apple. Last year, he was part of the five who got invited for the Apple apology tour. We made the Mac Pro, but we blew it. We painted ourselves into a corner. We can't make another one. Not this year, but we're working on it. Not this year. Panzerino got invited to. Now, I would love to know, Matthew, if you're watching, great reporting, but I'd like to know if Apple called you and said, would you like to come to the campus and see what we're doing in the Mac Pro, or if Matthew did some digging. In any event, he did go to the campus and was shown, all the work Apple's doing, and Apple used this as an opportunity to say, and by the way, it's not coming out this year. We're hoping not 2019.
Yeah.
And on the one hand, Matthew said, well, I'm glad that Apple's telling people who are now in this process of thinking about what Mac to buy, don't wait, buy it next year. That's a good thing. But it's also a very self-serving thing because Apple's saying, buy an iMac Pro right now because we aren't going to have the Mac Pro for you. It's really, it always cuts both ways. And in this case, Apple's very much manipulating people saying,
Don't wait. Buy a Mac Pro now, and we'll give you something next year to buy.
They're not selling many iMac Pros, by the way.
Not.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's our audience, you know.
I bought one, but that's
5,000.
What kind of nut am I? Yeah. Crazy.
But you did it for science, right? You're not using it to
I have to review it,
you know,
but then I get the distinct pleasure of getting to use it. Just what I need at home.
It runs Facebook
10 cores,
really fast.
32 gigs of RAM. You know what? It's not a. You can't tell it's fast.
You don't run on Facebook anyway.
No, I don't.
Killed Facebook.
I killed
for
Facebook
the last time.
But I hope. You know. Okay. I'm gonna be honest here. So I have gone through several stages of grief with Facebook. So a couple of weeks ago, I told you I deleted my account. You get 2 weeks, and this is new. This is the GDPR thing. Is that you can actually say delete it, and they give you 2 weeks to change your mind. My wife said, I mentioned this last week. But now I'm not married to anybody. It just says I'm married, but not to anybody because my name's gone.
Right.
So I said, oh, and I brought it back. And then I went, no. So I deleted it again.
So and then, do you get a new 2 weeks?
You get a new 2 weeks.
Okay. All right.
Every time you do this, you get a new 2 weeks. So then I thought, well, I shouldn't really delete it because what if somebody steals my name or I don't know. So I have now currently, I'm deactivated. But it's pointless in every respect. A, even if I deleted it, Facebook has my data.
It's too late.
It's too late. B, does this in any way register as a blip of any kind in Facebook's bottom line? Absolutely not. More people joined Facebook in the time it took to tell you this than everybody who quit totally so far, right? In the delete Facebook movement. So I've accomplished nothing. Mark Zuckerberg's not getting a signal. I've accomplished nothing. It just makes me feel better because I'm frankly, this is purely emotional. I think he's kind of creepy. And I think Facebook's kind of creepy. More so than anybody else. More than Google, more than anybody else.
Oh, that's why I deleted the app from my phone. It wasn't out of protest.
No.
It was a mental health move.
It's mental health.
Yeah. I just don't go. I haven't deleted my account. But I kind of just don't show up there.
I've been deleting Facebook since 2010. I'm proud.
But I have been, you know, that's the place that I tell people to really be careful about what you do more than any of the others.
Well, and every site you go to, whether you delete Facebook or not, registers, you know, if it's got a Facebook like or a login, registers your presence. So
I just got to say, you know, over the past couple of weeks, there have been all these how-to guides, how to delete Facebook, how to check to see if you were compromised.
DeleteFacebook.com.
Other people. Yeah. Like my favorite one is how to have the talk.
Yes.
If your data was stolen, how to have that talk with your friends. We are literally talking about personal data in the same using the same language and terms that we use to talk about STDs.
It is.
Right?
It is.
But, you know, we're not like engaging in like the equivalent of safe sex when we, you know, we're not protecting ourselves online in any
real right.
data hygiene. We definitely need data hygiene.
It's like we're telling people how to say you've got chlamydia without actually telling them how to use a condom.
That's
it's
right.
so funny.
Facebook is the new chlamydia.
It's so funny. This is exactly what I've been thinking about.
Because we get scraped on the back end.
Unless you get scraped on the back end. This is exactly what I've been thinking about with this topic, Amy. This is so funny because I was thinking that's the content that's needed is like good data hygiene. So we've actually been doing a little bit on this and planning to do more.
Good.
Because that's what's needed, right? Is the positive, proactive angle
of
what does good data hygiene look like online for an individual? And then how do you teach that to kids?
Do you teach people how to write your account deletion epitaph?
And there's such a thirst for that knowledge and that really important knowledge. I mean, I just wrote a little for my friends, a little thing on Facebook right after the Cambridge Analytica news started. And I was like, hey guys, here's something to know. Like if you ever want to take a quiz or take anything that looks like it is doing nothing in particular for itself. I was like, consider how that app within Facebook makes its money.
Yeah.
Is it obvious
we all
how
have
this
to get
app
more
is making its money?
Yes.
If it's not obvious how it's making its money off of you.
Yes.
And what you're sharing. So just think about that every single time you use something.
And when
how
you have
is this
small
making
children,
its money?
You have to teach them how to wipe their Facebook. I think that's important.
But my friends were so thankful. They were so like, oh my gosh, I hadn't thought about it that way.
We need to remind
people how business works.
Yeah.
Do your friends post photos of their kids on Facebook?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
All right. So then what the... I would then kind of like
we need to have the talk. I've been posting your picture on Facebook for 13 years.
Right. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, you don't put your picture, like if you're actually concerned about this stuff, then you have to exercise some self-restraint and don't put pictures of your kids' tushes in the bathtub on the Facebook. You know, I mean, it's part of this. This has been sort of a through line for this entire show tonight. But a lot of this just comes back to like life moves pretty fast. Technology moves faster than we do. And we got to, you know, stop and think about what we're doing.
You know who else ought to move fast? People in Mountain View. Because Waymo has just received a permit for no driver testing.
Oh, wow.
In California. And Mountain View is the first place. Watch out. There's Lexus's driving down the street. There's nobody inside. And I bet if it hits you, it just keeps going, right?
Who's so they're driving what? They've got like a trailer car behind it?
No. Talk about moving too fast. We just, you know, had this Uber issue, the Tesla issue.
Yeah.
Waymo confirmed on Friday the California Department of Motor Vehicles has approved its permit to test without a safety driver behind the wheel.
That's lobbying at work. That's amazing.
Wow.
It is amazing. Don't have to have a, yeah.
Yeah. So if you see a Chrysler minivan with strange accoutrement on the roof coming at you, run. There's nobody at the wheel.
Well, that's actually, you know, it's interesting, though. I bet you nobody at the California Department of Motor Vehicles asked in-depth questions about how secure the system is and if it's vulnerable to intrusion, outside intrusion.
No, I doubt it. I have to say, I mean, Waymo's done a lot better job than Uber with self-driving. Uber, I think the Uber record average was a driver had to take over every 13 miles, had to override the system.
Okay.
Well, and Waymo is something like, I can't remember what it was, it's hundreds
of
thousands.
Uber's having a hard time with object and image recognition and making some mistakes.
Yeah.
So.
And I think this all comes back again, like Waymo is part of a data company.
Yeah.
Uber
yeah.
is a transportation company right. that uses data.
Right.
It's kind of interesting. And I sort of wonder if part of Waymo's lobbying effort was just like, well, look at the statistics. We have many hours and miles of safe testing on a closed course.
Yeah, they've been doing this for a long time.
But you know what? Let's all hand it to the California Department of Motor Vehicles. That's probably literally the fastest they've ever moved on anything. Right? So we know it can be done. The next time we're all standing online, we're getting
that's really true. Waymo says that on average, once every 5,600 miles, a safety driver has had to take over compared to Uber's every 13 miles.
It's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, let me get that
pretty remarkable. Well, they've been at it for a long time, though. Remember, this is a secret project inside Google for a long time before we knew about it, and then we've also known about it for a long time.
Before Google was Alphabet.
Right, before Google was Alphabet. Thank you.
Should point out, though, that with no safety driver, there's not going to be somebody there every 5,600 miles to correct the car.
I wonder who's insuring them, because there's no actual, we don't have the insurance stuff figured out yet. So I wonder how
Google's probably self-insuring.
Yeah, I was just thinking the same thing.
Google insurance company.
I think so. Yeah.
Are we saying they have some money?
Wow. So, that's wild. Let's take a break.
Surprise.
Last ad, and then we can say a good night because it's as much as I love talking to you, this is probably gone on way too long. Our show today brought to you by, you know, I discovered something really cool. I use Sonos. We were talking about Sonos. And the Sonos app has now added Audible back in. You can listen to your audiobooks on your Sonos. This morning to celebrate, I had Ready Player One playing throughout the entire house. It was so awesome. Audible makes great audiobooks. Whether you like to listen to books to get away from it all, like Ready Player One, you like to learn. I do that too. I love reading history. I've been an Audible member since the year 2000. 18 years. That's kind of hard to believe. 18 years. Longer than I've been doing this show, I've been an Audible member. And I love Audible. You will too. The selection on Audible is phenomenal. Pretty much every book that comes out now comes out in audio as well as print so that you can get it day and date on Audible. I do that a lot. I'll pre-order books that I know are coming out that I'm very excited about reading. When Bill Gates said my favorite book was Steven Pinker's Better Angel of Our...
Angels of Our Better Nature.
Angels of Our Better Nature. I immediately got it on Audible. And that's another nice thing. You don't have to... You get a book immediately. You go to audible.com/twit, and you can get a book for free right now. and you're downloading it and you're listening within, you know, seconds. That's pretty cool. Jason, your book's on Audible.
It is on Audible. And as a matter of fact, if you go to Audible and you listen to the sample chapter, it is the chapter number 9.
About me.
Neil Laporte.
Yeah.
Probably,
people are sick of that by now.
Yes.
That's adorable, you guys.
Read by yours truly as well.
Yeah.
My book is also on there, but
yes.
Not read by me. But a professional person who knows how to read a book out loud to other people read
yeah.
it.
Yeah. No, it's so good. I have to say, every book on Audible is something you learn, something you can enjoy, something you can escape to. I was just looking at my Audible library, and I have a pretty good mix of fiction and nonfiction. I learn a lot from Audible. I'm going to Japan, so I'm just reading Haruki Murakami's Wind-Up Bird Chronicle. I don't know if you've read that, Amy, but it's really funny.
Mm-hmm. Hey, can I ask a question since we're talking about books and Audible?
Yeah.
Is it what books has everybody... I just finished Born by Jeff Vandermeer.
I don't know that book. Tell me about
that. It's weird and crazy. He's the guy who wrote Annihilation.
Oh.
Mm.
So you want science fiction or horror?
It's
or?
Sort of dystopian futures. You know, it's yeah. me.
So I'm reading, I went way back and I'm reading Even Cowgirls Get the Blues.
Love that.
Yeah,
a great book.
Yeah. And you know what? Like, it's working for me right now. It's totally escapist, but also the most fantastic use of metaphor I've ever encountered. Like, just the wildest
metaphor.
She
had giant thumbs because she hitchhiked.
She hitchhiked because she had giant thumbs.
Or vice versa. Ooh. Yeah, that's a big distinction.
Interesting. There's a new one that I'm about to do because the second season of Handmaid's Tale is about to come out. There's a new version. It's Claire Danes
yes.
who did a reading of the original, but this one is a performance version where there's other voices.
I love
well.
Those. When Audible does that, it's nice. Really cool because it brings a book to life. I love Tom Robbins. You know, you got me kind of in the mood.
I love Tom Robbins.
Yeah.
Half Asleep in Frog Pajamas is one of my favorite books of all time.
I listened on Audible way back in 2010 to Fierce Invalids from Hot Climates, Home from Hot
That's
Climates.
That's good, too.
That was a great book.
Tom Robbins on audio has got to be great.
Yeah, it is.
Did he read it himself?
No.
Okay.
Just the words, right? It's such fun words to read.
Yeah. No, it's like, you know who else is great in Audible? Vonnegut, kind of for the same reason. They write like they speak, very naturally, and you can hear the voice.
I want Jeff Bridges to read Tom Robbins' books.
The dude should read Tom Robbins.
He should, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Or Vonnegut, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll have one other recommendation. It's a nonfiction one, though. Whiplash by Joey Ito and Jeff Howe.
Love Joey Ito.
How to Survive Our Faster Future.
Yeah.
So a lot of this is how, you know, because we're in a world where we're absorbing so much data and things are moving so much faster, you know, a lot of the laws and principles that we've worked on in business and life and culture, you know, we're breaking them, and we have to be comfortable with that and think about them differently. So Whiplash.
Listening to business books on Audible is really cool.
Yeah.
It's a great way to kind of take the time that you're in the car or walking the dog or doing the dishes and make some use of it.
Get a little smarter. Yeah,
get a little smarter.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know what's cool about the Vonnegut books? They have movie stars reading them all. Audible's really good at choosing voices. James Franco reads Slaughterhouse-Five. Tony Roberts reads Cat's Cradle. I want to hear John Malkovich read Breakfast of Champions.
Oh, that would be
wow.
good.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be something?
Yeah.
So it goes. I listened to Galapagos before I went to the Galapagos. Turns out it's not really about the Galapagos, but it still is.
It was
a great book. I really enjoyed it. And the Galapagos does figure in it. It's just not a natural history or anything.
It's not a travel guide.
I kind of feel like you should have a book club, Leo.
I've always wanted to do an Audible book club because I listen to so many Audible books. Welcome to the Monkey House. This is a dramatization with David Strathairn, Maria Tucci, Bill Irwin, Tony Roberts, and Dylan Baker. That would be awesome. See, this is the fun part. If you're an Audible subscriber, when you get together with other Audible subscribers, which apparently we all are, coincidentally, what you do is you talk about, what'd you hear lately? What's a great book? Audible facilitates this. You can now send books, share books from your library with anyone. If it's their first time, they listen free. You could share audio excerpts. I really like this from your favorite books.
That's awesome.
So if you listen to something and say, oh, this is really good. Jason's got to hear this. I can send this to you. Mm. A lot of people listen to our podcast faster. You can do that with Audible, too, or slower. Get the narration you want. If you're an Amazon Kindle user and you use WhisperSync, you can buy the book on the Kindle as well as the audiobook and watch as it reads or switch back and forth. So listen, you get home, you can read it if you like to read books on a Kindle. Audible members get a credit every month, good for any audiobook, regardless of price. Unused credits roll over. Although I never have unused credits, I look forward to my reset date, which is the 22nd of every month, and I immediately jump in because I have an Audible wish list as long as my arm books.
You know, they have a great feature too that I recently discovered. If you used a credit on a book and you didn't like it, you can exchange that credit for another book.
That's really nice.
Yeah. So I
no questions asked exchanges.
No questions asked.
And with Audible, you're not renting. These books are yours to keep. I have my library, because I've been an Audible member so long, is hundreds and hundreds of books. And I often go back and reread favorites, especially when, you know, just I need even Cal Grogs Get the Blues to get me through the night. And then I got it, which is really, really nice.
I forgot. I love that book. I'm going to re-download it.
Me too. I did a lot of John Irving's, too, like Cider House Rules. Mm-hmm. For some reason, they remind
me. Narrative.
Yeah, they're great stories, but they're real, and they're fun. Get a free audiobook right now. You get a 30-day free trial. Here's two ways to do it. You can go to audible.com/twit. We've got a new way. If you know, most people listen to Audible on their phone, so you could just use your phone and text TWIT, T-W-I-T, to 500-500. That's the short code. That's as easy as you can get. You get a link back, you click, that's it, you're done. Text TWIT to 500-500 or go to audible.com/twit, audible.com/twit, or text TWIT to 500-500. You'll get a link, a free book, and a whole world of amazing literature awaits you. That's how these people got so smart. Now I know why you all are so darn smart.
Oh, I forgot. I just remembered another recommendation. Hamilton, the Revolution. They did the story of how they created Hamilton.
That I got to read.
Terrific audiobook.
Got to read that.
Yeah.
I think you just made a great shout out to English majors.
English majors are pretty much everybody. Because we couldn't get a real job.
Yes? In the future, people who have, we all focus on STEM, but the people who are going to fare pretty well going forward are people who have had very rigorous liberal arts degrees with super concentrated abilities to do critical thinking and comparative reasoning and logic. So
analysis.
I would submit, I reject the notion that you're one or the other, you're left brain or right brain. Do both. The secret to my success in life, and I bet you to all of yours too, is that you understand technology, that you have an affinity for STEM, for science, for technology, for engineering, for math, but you also can talk or write and explicate. Mm-hmm. And we really need that. And I do think, Amy, that STEM gives you a logic foundation in a way that no
sure, but not in exchange for comparative, like the best possible degree would be, instead of algebra, like applied mathematics, more practical applied mathematics.
That's what coding is. Like coding is applied mathematics.
And world religion. Yeah. And, you know, like that makes you a super powerful person if you're able to do all of that.
And you know, one thing that this whole panel represents is lifelong learners. That you got a good foundation and you never stop learning, that you still read, you still learn, you're still inquisitive. That's
really because no matter what happens, nobody can take away what you've learned. Like nobody can take away your education, which is why education is paramount.
I completely agree with you. But take a coding class as well as a comparative religions class. They're both great.
Yeah, well, we should do it all. That's
do it
the
all,
thing, right?
Why say I can't do that? I can't do that.
That's why all good liberal arts schools and most big, wonderful public universities, require you to take a number of different types of courses so that you can think that way.
I am a big proponent of a lot of high school math curricula is not very good these days.
Yeah.
But there is good coding curriculum out there.
Learn math through coding.
That will help you learn math and logic and technology. I interviewed a guy who's a professor of computer science at Brown University. I'm trying to remember the name. It was on triangulation. The name of his, they have a school curriculum that any math teacher can teach. It doesn't matter if you don't know coding. And it's really good, and it's free, and it's available.
While you're looking that up, I have kind of a funny story. And when I was in high school calculus, my high school calculus teacher, and I took this as an insult at the time, he said, you're kind of like the best non-math student I've had. And now, much later, I'm like, no, that was a compliment. I'm going to take that because...
Yeah, I know that. Like, that's a good one.
I'm going to own that.
One.
Yeah. The best non-mathy math student.
This is the page. It's bootstrapworld.org. And I really love this idea. They have lesson plans. They have actually classes that you can take as a teacher. They've got ongoing support from the National Science Foundation. It is a way to bring math, physics, and coding
smart
into the classroom for basically for high schools.
That's
but
great.
I would say smart middle schooler could benefit from this as well. And if you're by the way, they're one of the largest providers of formal computer science education to girls and underrepresented students nationwide. They really do a great job of getting diversity.
Okay. And I would just
my calculus teacher said, you're the worst student I've ever had. And I don't know why you're taking calculus. That's almost a direct quote.
That's really insulting.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's almost a direct quote. So I dropped the class. Yeah.
It may not feel like a rigorous liberal arts program is going to prepare you for the job market over the next 3 to 5 years, and it probably will not. So I just want to clarify what I said. I'm talking about 20 years out. So kid, you know, I've got a 7-year-old, and by virtue of her being 7 and growing up in my household, she's getting exposure to quite a bit of code and tech.
Good for her. That's great.
But, you know, if you think about the hybrid skill sets and all the really interesting new kinds of jobs that will never have existed before but will need to exist 20 years from now, some, you know, like humans who have like really great abilities to, you know, think critically, understand logic, you know, write, communicate.
I agree 100%.
Like that's going to be really important because a machine is not going to be able to do that.
To connect the dots. That reminds me of something too. We've been interviewing interns, and we interviewed this young fella from Harvard, and he told me something that I thought was really interesting, that they don't allow you to declare a major now until your junior year.
Hallelujah.
And so, which I thought is great because most kids change 3 times by then, right?
There was a reverse trend going on for a while where you had to declare before you got into college.
I know. Terrible.
Terrible.
But their approach is actually similar to what Amy's saying, is that they want you to come in and have, whether you're going to major in computer science or drama or pre-med or whatever, they want you to come in and get a broad-based exposure to different things. And as a matter of fact, they require that you are involved in an activity that's part of your credits. And so instead of having to do it on your own time, you know, you have that built in, whether it's, you know, cheer squad or the magazine or the newspaper, whatever it is. And so this fellow that we were interviewing that was really smart, he said, you know, I had to pick something. And so I picked a newspaper because I was like, well, that looks easy, right? And which is something to tell an editor in an interview, you know, but then again.
I couldn't do calculus, so I'm here.
And so, but he's like, I love it. Like,
did he find out? This is a Harvard kid?
This is a Harvard kid.
So he was writing for the Crimson?
Yeah. He's like, and he found out that he loved it. And he not only was did the newspaper, but he did the magazine too. And so, so very super cool. And I thought that was a really good sign that the... that, you know, at least one institution, and obviously where Harvard goes, a lot of colleges tend to follow, was embracing this idea that no matter what you learn, you critical thinking, analysis, having a broad, you know, learning profile is going to suit you, you know, really well.
What was your major?
My major? Yeah. It was journalism, until I had these fights with my journalism professors about that all the future was going to be online. And they said, no, they tried that in HyperCard down in Florida, and people just don't want to read screens.
All people did in Florida with the interactive tests was buy stamps. That shows you how long ago that was.
The online thing is neat, but it's not going to ever happen.
Never
and
happen.
I'm like, this
we
is
instantaneous. We tried it with Prodigy. It's just not going to happen.
And so I'd have these, and finally I was like, I just can't learn anything from these people. In my very 18-year-old way, was like, I'm not going to learn anything from these people. They're complete idiots, which was dumb. So I changed to, I went to Indiana University, and they have a thing that's called Create Your Own Major, the College of Arts and Sciences.
What did you create?
So I did a mix of history and English and Middle Eastern studies.
That's really cool.
So that's what Amy would prescribe.
Small world. Jason, where are you from?
I'm from Fort Wayne, Indiana, and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
So I am a region rat. I'm from Northwest Indiana.
Yeah.
And I was on a full ride for the music school. So I went to IU somewhat against my will.
You got a couple of Hoosiers here.
That's crazy.
Yeah. My parents said I was allowed to go anywhere I wanted, but I had to have the same deal, which of course I wasn't going to get.
Yeah.
So I went to the music school. I made it through my freshman year recital. I was a clarinet performance major. Dropped out, didn't tell anybody. And then quietly switched over. And I did the same kind of degree that you did. So mine was game theory, political science, and economics.
Nice.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, so that's crazy. Small world.
Very cool, yes.
I was an English major at Harvard at the time.
Did you work on the Crimson?
I did.
Oh,
I was
a
Crimson editor. In fact, I co-edited the magazine.
You were the editor of the Crimson?
No, I was the co-editor of 15 Minutes, which is the weekly magazine of the Harvard Crimson. But the point that I was getting to was that at the time, Harvard was pretty snobby about vocational anything. Like, applied math was the only degree at Harvard.
You're here to learn about the world.
Right. There was
to be a leader.
There was very, like, you could take computer science at Harvard, but it was really, really abstract. It wasn't very hands-on. But here was the interesting thing. Because of that, the Crimson it has nothing to do with Harvard University. I mean, except obviously it has everything to do with Harvard University, but it's not run by the university. It's completely funded by the students. We own our own presses, funded by the students, technically off campus. And what was interesting was that we were running a full-fledged website at the time, even though it was brand new, because there was nobody to tell us not to.
Yeah.
Right? It was the students kind of going like, we have to have this, so we're going to start it. And that was cool. It was like, okay, well, let's take that vocational part and move it kind of off campus. And I'm glad to hear that now they're kind of acknowledging that and helping people move into it.
So you see, that's kids, awesome. You never know. Just get that education. Be cool. Stay in school.
And someday, is fine.
Yeah, English is fine. It doesn't really matter. Learn as much as you can for as long as you can, really.
Yes.
What a great panel. Amy Webb, love having you on. The signals are talking. Why today's...
Thanks. Can I...
Yes.
Oh, sorry.
Plug.
Can I plug? So our annual report just came out. It's almost 300 pages long.
Where's mine?
And it's free.
Where's mine?
I sent one.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Karsten, are you bogarting the annual report? Don't bogart
This year, so it's our annual report on emerging tech trends for the coming year. Yes. This year, there's 225 across 20 industries. It's it's all free, so you can get it online at our website, and we printed like a handful of hard copies. But it debuted at South by Southwest, and now it's everywhere. So,
future exciting. todayinstitute.com, and
I'm downloading it now.
Tech Trends Report available for download.
How many months do you spend working on that? Probably a lot. That looks hard.
No, I mean this is our 11th annual, our 11th edition. So we've been doing this for 11 years.
Wow.
You know, it takes a couple of months, but it's the research that we're always doing. Last year, 2 years ago, I open sourced all of my methodology, research tools and everything. Cause I want other people to use them and build on them.
Wow.
So we give everything away for free.
That's really awesome.
That's amazing.
Isn't that nice? Look, here's your reading list.
Together our new one's coming out, in 2 weeks. So I think pretty strongly that, like, if you want to understand the future, you also have to pay attention to sci-fi.
I can live with that. Okay.
So we put together a reading and listening list every quarter and encourage people to read and watch and listen. So,
it's really cool, Amy. You have not only created your own major, you've created your own job, really. And well done.
Well done.
FutureTodayInstitute.com. Lindsay Turrentine took that that career at the Harvard Crimson and brought it to us all, editor-in-chief at CNET.com. Anything you want to plug that's going on?
I want to vaguely plug what we're doing later this week in the smart home territory, because it's a secret and I can't talk about it yet, but I'll be able to talk about it later this week.
Okay.
So Thursday, check out CNET. You won't be able to miss it.
CNET.com.
That sounds cool.
Thursday, something is coming.
Something's coming.
How exciting.
Jason Hunter, he's here for RSA. You can find his work, of course, at Tech Republic. He's editor-in-chief. Anything you want to plug?
Yeah, every month, ZDNet and Tech Republic come together, all of our editors across the globe. We have editors in editors all over the world, contributors all over the world. We come together and we have 10 features, essentially, that we do on the most important topics in tech. And so this month's is cybersecurity. And so you can go to ZDNet and go to you can see it sort of on the front page there if you scroll down. All of our monthly features are there. So if you come every month, you can get all the latest sort of our own research as well as our journalists on the ground, you know, in all the English speaking parts of the world. So yeah, next month is the Internet of Things.
How exciting.
The industrial Internet of Things.
You guys are all doing such exciting, interesting work. Now, I'm off for vacation. I won't be here next week. Ian Thompson will be hosting. Becky Worley will be hosting the week following, so that'll be a lot of fun. I'll be back on May 6th, but I'll be it'll be a fun one to watch because I'll be just back, so I'll be incredibly jet-lagged.
But full of Japanese words.
And full of Japanese words, and I'm hoping sushi. and maybe a few other things, including a hot dog bun with brown spaghetti in it. I don't know. Amy said
it's
I should eat
delicious.
That.
Eat one for me.
It sounds like the Japanese version of spaghetti tacos.
Oh, God.
Which is like a kid's favorite.
Like a nightmare. But I'm going to try it because Amy Webb knows all and tells all. And thank you all for being here. We do TWiT every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, 2200 UTC. If you want to be in studio, we invite you to just email tickets at twit.tv. We love our in-studio audience. You guys are always great. Michael O'Donnell's working on beating his record at the old Screensavers show. How many Screensavers did you see?
Like over 100.
Over 100. You're not close to that yet on TWiT, but you're getting there. We love having him. You can follow him on Twitter, at Photo, and he always posts fun photos from the episodes. So look for those, at Photo on Twitter. If you can't be here in person, you can watch the stream live from wherever you are, anywhere in the world. Just go to twit.tv/live. If you do that, though, I invite you to join us in the chat room. You could be the smart kids in the back of the class, the Wiseacres, the Weisenheimers. The chat room is at irc.twit.tv. TV. And of course, if you're busy Sunday evenings, you can always get an on-demand version of our show and listen at your leisure. You'll find those at our website. We're going all the way back to TWiT number one from April 17th, 2005.
Amazing.
13 years.
That's ago. Mark Zuckerberg in the frame, isn't it there?
I think that is. It's Mark Zuckerberg. He was just an 8-year-old at the time. TWiT.tv. You'll find downloadable versions, audio and video there. You can also subscribe in your favorite podcatcher. In fact, I invite you to subscribe. That way you won't miss a single episode. Thanks for being here. I'll see you in a couple of weeks. Another TWiT
this is
in the
amazing.
Can.